Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
They fully understand exactly what they need to do. If their fear, white fear, see, and we always, in all the articles about black men being shot, what do they say? Black teenager does not have weapons. Big white man with guns, eight white men with guns. Maybe some of them have two guns and a taser. And I was afraid. Isn't that what they say?
Yep.
So I had to shoot him 16 times. I was so afraid. What am I afraid of? Not man with glasses class. Diagram of male genitalia. Testicle, phallus. What is in the testicles? The genetic material. Now, if we just learned our history and stayed familiar with our history, right after emancipation, so-called, where the black people were off of the plantations and could walk around a little bit. Then they started, what? Chasing down black men, lynching, and castrating. Is that right? What is castrating? Cutting off the genitals and the testicles. See, white people would cut it off and take it home. Cut it off and eat it. Let me ask you all this. I was talking to one of my sisters last night. I said, what are the most expensive foods in the world? That's a question class. What are the most expensive foods in the world? Okay, he can get an A. That's one, right? Go, class. Truffles. Caviar, not oysters, and chocolate. Now, isn't this is the most important stuff that they can, you know, if you're really rich, you can buy some little black caviar, eggs, and take them in. what's the guy's name on the TV who's Morning Joe? Huh? Scarborough, okay. Now, do you know what is Joe? Coffee. And who is Joe? Oh, Black Joe. I mean, that's why Starbucks is a billionaire company. I got to be putting some of that black stuff in. I can't get started. If somebody were to say to Joe Scarborough, you're talking about taking in old Black Joe. I remember in the Second World War, my dad was in the war. Why do you call it Joe? Dad said, it stands for old Black Joe. See, that was the most important thing in the Army, your coffee. Morning Joe, you know, right? See, all of this stuff is connected. And this is why I was afraid, white fear. I was afraid of the black man. See, there's no history. There's no history on the planet of black men attacking white men's genitals.
Context of White Supremacy, Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, February 24th, 2017, so I have been told. This is our fifth study session on the late Vincent Woodard's The Delectable Negro, Human Consumption and Homoeroticism in U.S. Slave Culture. We're picking up on Chapter 3, A Tale of Hunger, Retold, Ravishment and Hunger in F. Douglass's Life and Writing, Frederick Douglass. We are close to the end of the third chapter, so you just have to pick up where we left off at, talking about Douglass's admiration for Abraham Lincoln. The only thing I'll say that was the late Dr. Frances Cress Welsing from her final lecture at the Welsing Institute. I thought that put things in the proper context going into today's program, that maybe some of this consumption is rooted in melanin deficiency. Dr. Frances Cress Welsing. Moving forward, The Delectable Negro, audio segment number one, context of white supremacy.
A part of what made Lincoln so attractive to Douglass was the president's apparent commitment to freeing enslaved persons. Both Tubman and Brown, of sacred memory, sacrificed their lives for enslaved persons. It is something of the slave in Douglass, the one who has had to constantly battle for freedom and a place to rest, who sees finally in Lincoln the maternal bosom, an emblem of a final resting place. He relates to Lincoln as a romanticizing male child, to a male-to-female romantic object. Lincoln is in turn depicted as male patriarch, as maternal figure, as fecund female earth. The undercurrent of mother hunger blurs gender boundaries and causes Douglass to transfer to Lincoln a measure of unrequited love and feelings of mother loss. Descriptions of Miss Lucretia Auld years earlier on the Auld plantation prefigure his descriptions of Lincoln. Miss Auld, he writes, had bestowed upon me such words and looks as taught me that she pitied me if she did not love me. In a related instance aboard a steamer, Douglass encounters Edward Marshall, a California congressman. He describes Marshall in terms that are both deific and evoke the natural world. The catalyst for Douglass when describing Marshall in this manner is a racist incident aboard the steamer. The captain orders Douglass to be physically removed from the dining room. Marshall rebuffs the steward with eyes full of fire. Douglass sees lightning flash and imagines this saving individual as a deity of the sky with golden hair and fiery eyes, whose voice resounded like a clap of summer thunder. In this instance, Douglas casts himself in the most effeminate role, describing Marshall as chivalrous, gallant, and possessed of generous and manly qualities. Not coincidentally, Marshall has just come from Kentucky, where he visited his black mammy. "I was nursed at the breast of a colored mother," he admits. Both Lincoln and Marshall intervene on behalf of the freed slave. Their allegiance to abolitionism evokes in Douglas romantic feelings that range from the maternal cast to a glorification of the white male as the emblem of the natural world and the natural order of things. Marshall does not take on the sacred significance and emotional completement of the black mother. Instead, black mother as emblem of infantile hunger, the white man nursing at the black woman's breast, is cause for shared affection between the two men. Douglas was in a phase of his life when he believed that proximity to black nobility and empathy could change whites. He would realize, though, after finding out about Lincoln's support of the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, that Northern whites had used him in the enslaved person's cause to further their nationalist and other political aims. At the undraping of a bust carved in Lincoln's honor years later, Douglas would describe Lincoln not as a caring, valiant, romantic object, but as one who had betrayed his love and affections. Speaking before hundreds of white persons at this honorary occasion, Douglas regrettably reminds those gathered of Lincoln's hypocrisy and willingness to sacrifice black people. He says, "He was ready to execute all the supposed guarantees of the United States Constitution in favor of the slave system anywhere inside the slave states. He was willing to pursue, recapture, and send back the fugitive slave to his master, and to suppress a slave rising for liberty though his guilty master were already in arms against the government." Lincoln's willingness to send a fugitive slave back to his master was most painful to Douglas, who was himself an escaped slave. In this public address, Douglas speaks about how he, as a representative of the slave experience, felt betrayed by one he was so willing to love, admire, and seek solace in. Speaking to his white fellow citizens, Douglas admonishes, "First, midst, and last, you and yours were the objects of his deepest affection and his most earnest solicitude. You are the children of Abraham Lincoln. We are at best only his stepchildren, children by adoption, children by forces of circumstances and necessity. To you it especially belongs to sound his praises, to preserve and perpetuate his memory, to multiply his statues." Douglas speaks of white people as children, Lincoln's true children, and of black people as stepchildren. This statement harkens back to the problematic issue of kinship between white and black men during slavery. Douglas is a free man, a man of agency and affluence, but still the historical problem of relatedness and all of its emotional and sexual implications bear down upon him in the present. It is during slavery that the orator first develops the habit of romanticizing and identifying himself with the white male aristocracy. When he leaves the Covey plantation, he contrasts Covey's membership in the demeaned overseer class to that of a Mr. Freeland. Freeland acts towards him with the sentiment of honor, a sense of justice, and a feeling of humanity. Mr. Freeland belongs to that class of slaveholder admired and affectionately thought of by the slaves. Slaves were not, Douglas notes, insensible to the whole-souled qualities of a generous, dashing slaveholder who was fearless of consequences, and they preferred a master of this bold and darking kind, even with the rise of being shot down for imprudence. Following this logic of aristocratic refinement, one can understand how Douglass found in Lincoln the perfect embodiment of the ennobled father figure. In reality, Lincoln's response to black people ranged from repulsion to exotic fascination. He enjoyed minstrel culture and had minstrel troupes come to the White House to entertain him, and also was known to attend shows when he visited Chicago. Most whites presume that white blood gave the Negro higher intelligence, beauty, and more evolved sensibilities. The very high cultural standards that Douglass used to distinguish himself from the base Negro are the same standards that make him attractive to and ultimately dispensable to the president. By calling attention to their kinship bond, Douglass reveals how deeply intertwined issues of relatedness between black and white men with the subject of nation formation are for him. Lincoln fails, as the father-mother figure, to live up to Douglass's natal and maternal expectations, and he confirms in Douglass the permanence of his orphaned, homeless social status. As maternal caretaker and sustainer of the central tenets of the Republic, Douglass expects that Lincoln will give rebirth to the slave, not just freeing him in word from slavery, but birthing him into a social and political body that cancels out the social death of slavery. By the time Douglass makes the speech before the Freedmen's Monument and begins years later to work on the Life and Times, he has seen Reconstruction efforts go drastically awry. The Freedmen's Savings Bank fiasco, the stealing of land promised to freed persons, and the erection of Jim Crow laws served as indicators of how the nation seemed intent on keeping the slave buried, freed from the coffin of slavery, but socially dead in all other respects. Driven by the need for a collective rebirth of himself and the masses of black people, Douglass would ultimately locate his regenerative capacity in himself. Mother hunger, the sense of being orphaned from the nation, the desire for intimate belonging, and his own personal legacy of sexual violation would fuel and define Douglass's attempts at self and national rebirth. Beginning to realize an interconnection between the rebirth of the nation and personal rebirth, Douglass broke from white abolitionists. In opposition to predominant abolitionist views, Douglass became convinced that there were no necessity for dissolving the union between the northern and southern states. He felt that the vote was power and that the Constitution of the United States not only contained no guarantees in favor of slavery, but, on the contrary, it is, in its letter and spirit, an anti-slavery instrument, demanding the abolition of slavery as a condition of its own existence as the supreme law of the land. Breaking from abolitionists and feeling more freed from his slave past did not mean that Douglass did not have to contend with white male desires, with white male appetites within a culture of consumption. If anything, Douglass understood better how the plantation was a little nation of its own, and how the nation operated in many respects like the plantation. Douglass came to a much fuller understanding of the plantation as an incestuous household nation and the larger republic as a social grave and promise of stillborn birth. As I argued earlier in this chapter, throughout history, black men have typically imagined this dynamic of birth and domesticity in their writings in oppressive female terms. Douglass does this in all his autobiographies, through depictions of black women raped, especially his mother and his aunts. But what I want to draw our attention to is how this potentially fecund space was also depicted in his fiction and nonfiction writings as a male womb-type space, a regenerative space with capacity to give birth to self, nation, and transform citizenry. The idea that was that if Douglass and black men like himself could give birth to the nation, then they could, on terms of their own, finally exist. It was a homosocial maternity that Douglass conceived that still largely excluded women and black female maternity on practical feminist levels. Still, this gesture toward embodying his hunger for liberty and social acknowledgement points us to entirely new ways of thinking about racial legacy and black masculinity in the 19th century. The Heroic Slave, Douglass's only published fictional work, teems with references to black male fecundity. Published in 1852, this text, in title and storyline, continues what would be Douglass's lifelong project of elevating and glorifying the heroic black male figure. The hero of the story, Madison Washington, is a composite figure based partly on the leader of the revolt aboard the slave ship Creole and President George Washington. The story opens with the narrator having the reader peer into the dark, a dark pregnant with liberty and the legacy of Patrick Henry, who led all the armies of the American colonies through the Great War for Freedom and Independence. We are told that someone is enveloped in darkness and then taken into the searching dark, only to return from the pursuit like a wearied and disheartened mother after a tedious and unsuccessful search for a lost child. This maternal darkness takes on human form a few pages into the story when the darkness Washington steps with, arms like polished iron, a face black but comely, a brow as dark as glossy as the raven's wing. At the beginning of the story, it is Washington who prays in the darkness, who draws into his speaking John Listwell, a northern white man who feels compelled to stop, descend from his horse, and listen. Listwell, whom we might also think of as Listens Well, we learn, had long desired to sound the mysterious depths of the thoughts and feelings of a slave. As his eye catches hold of Madison in the shadows, he trembles with terror and excitement. Washington's prayer titillates Listwell, who receives his remonstrations as a type of erotic climax. He did not have to wait long. There came another gush from the same full fountain, now bitter and now sweet. Afterward, Washington takes on a glow to his countenance and teems with a hope of freedom that seemed to sweeten the bitter cup of slavery. The fact that Washington ruminates on his wife, Susan, in the darkness and experiences anguish at the thought of having to leave her to escape north further highlights the clandestine erotic sharing that Listwell experiences. He experiences Washington, and through Washington, the passion the enslaved man feels for his wife. This copulating in the mysterious, impregnated dark results in a rebirth for Listwell. Washington leaves the pine forest and begins his trek north to freedom, but his white interloper is forever changed. "From this hour, I am an abolitionist," he swears to himself. "I have seen enough and heard enough, and I shall go to my home in Ohio, resolved to atone for my past indifference to this ill-starred race by making such exertions as I should be able to do for the speedy emancipation of every slave in the land." For all of its representational problems, which I will attend to shortly, this scenario is a striking break from the historical tradition of representing the black female body as the dark, chaotic interior of black experience. It is a unique moment through which we can imagine and begin to think about a politics of black male interiority and hunger, moving beyond images of white males ravishing his body in the past and controlling the terms of erotic engagement. Douglass scripts a homoerotic interchange that is mutually beneficial. According to P. Gabriel Forman, at the time that Douglass pens his story, He is acutely aware that white men are the only reader citizens imbued with legal standing as witnesses. They are his only politically embodied readers. The only ones, that is, with a vote. So as a way of harnessing this political power, Douglass attempts to seduce white male readers. Seduction is the means to constructing a new genealogy of African nativity based in the copulation of the black and white male. The character of Washington combines several strands of American radicalism in one person. He is a reference to the black plantation insurrectionists and to the founding revolutionary fathers of America, specifically George Washington and Patrick Henry. Before the House of Burgesses in 1775, Henry stated in his Liberty or Death speech, 3 millions of people armed in the holy cause of liberty, and in such a country which we possess, are invincible by any force which our enemy can send against us. This mandate for national security and fortitude remained unfulfilled in Douglass's mind with the continuance of slavery. Referencing the Henry speech in the Life and Times, he writes, "It was a great thing to achieve American independence when we numbered 3 millions, but it was a greater thing to save this country from dismemberment when it numbered 30 millions." Douglass imagines the heroic male slave as the receptacle of the unrealized national vision Henry espoused. Douglass unites in his womb the opposite and contradictory forces of white paternity and black maternal legacy. Henry and Washington represent something of Douglass's own whiteness, his lifelong problematic relationship to white male paternal figures. Taking their seminal visions into himself, while problematic, is for Douglass the only choice if he is to make peace and home of an America plagued by white male immorality. Choosing to be a receptacle acknowledges as well the political reality of black people effeminized and eroticized by whites. Douglass's choice does not ameliorate the stigma and challenges of assuming effeminate posture. Rather, it serves as an example of one black man crafting agency and negotiating complex, fluid notions of gender at the same time that he experiences himself as circumscribed by these ideas. There is a passage in My Bondage and My Freedom where Douglass refers to his mother as resembling an Egyptian pharaoh. He writes, "There is in Pritchard's Natural History of Man the head of a figure. On page 157, the features of which so resemble those of my mother, that I often recur to it with something of the feeling which I suppose others experience when looking upon the pictures of dear departments." Some have questioned why Douglass chose to represent his mother with the image of a male pharaoh. This is an important question considering that in the same volume there are images of Hindu women and northern and southern African types that would have been more appropriate and accurate examples of Douglass's mother. If we think, though, of the image as a meshing of Douglass's maternal legacy with the reformation of the U.S. empire, then it makes sense. Douglass recasts his mother as an ancestral figure and a bridge to an ancient African royal lineage. By depicting his mother as Ramses II, not only does he ennoble her, he also establishes, by virtue of his bloodline, his natural right to claim to the American legacy. This image of a male mother, presented in the second and third installments of his autobiography, reinforces how emotional Natal needs confounding prevailing nationalist gender politics. Douglass's consistent move to externalize his Natal hunger is instructive. It seems that implicitly he understood that in order not to be consumed by feelings of loss and the sense of emotional and spiritual dislocation that threatened him from without, he would have to actualize his emotional needs, his hungers. In the image of the male mother and his depictions of the fecund heroic male, we are shown how hunger facilitates a deeper grounding in geography and place and enables him to locate himself in history and in the context of national reformation. The heroic figure embodies Douglass's ideas of the Constitution as an essentially anti-slavery document. He conveys his idea of suffrage for black men through his heroic male, who is male and female, a combination of women's suffrages, politics, and male slave abolitionist strivings. His hunger is male and female, or perhaps better understood as a cauldron of self and experience that syncretized the two. Hunger is power, or at least the means to accessing power encased within the discourse of nation. David Leverance has noted that Douglass's entrepreneurial notion of manhood meant not freedom so much as dominance and the fear of humiliation. As I have argued throughout this chapter, there was no humiliation deeper or more unspeakable than the sexual humiliation suffered by one man at the hands of another. Black men found the feminizing outcomes of such abuse untenable, as they translated neither into the preferred dominance over nor access to the entrepreneurial benefits of American capitalism. Yet the idea of Douglass as fecund and the image of the male mother suggest that things were not quite so simple. The image of the male mother is a syncretic figure that adds up, ultimately, to more than the sum of its parts. For example, while the male mother is a new emblem of the nation, it is also a deeply personal metaphor for Douglass, who himself, herself, gives birth to this symbol of the new. The male mother is a coded representation of the ways that male-male relations for Douglass took form from a fluid sense of gender and the consistent goal of whites to make the male slave into a feminine relational object. From the framework of the male mother, we see that Douglass was aware of and acted from a place of gender indeterminacy or fluidity. If we acknowledge this complex facet of his self-awareness and representational politics, then we must also acknowledge a broader understanding of who Douglass was and what he means to us in the present. In the 1960s and 70s, historians and activists sought to recover Douglass from the dark 19th century past as the tradition's very own representative man. At the end of the 20th century, cultural critics and feminist scholars such as McDowell, Charles Clifton, and Foreman began to unpack Douglass's heroic masculinity and suggested a more complicated genealogy or genealogies of Douglass's masculinity and personal legacy. I am advocating that our newer scholarship on Douglass integrate and apply the complex vision we now have of his person and contribution. We should see him simultaneously as a heroic male, a male daughter, a fecund birth-giving male, a male child who was raped, a striving and self-serving patriarch, and an ennobled father of black letters and liberation. If I had to choose a more central motivation fueling these multiple overlapping and intersecting identities, I would choose hunger over and beyond reason, falling back upon the female genealogy of hunger and consumption in Vince in Douglass's maternal relations and in his own embodied feminine sensibilities. Hunger, as I'm thinking of it, is logical, reasoning, and strategic. It is also embodied, sensate, and intuitive. Hunger is a meditating, alchemical ground, a point from which Douglass consistently translated what was felt and desired into reasoned action, rhetorical performance, and civic belonging, as problematic as this always was. It is out of Douglass's hunger and a response to forces that threatened to consume him that he dreamed, envisioned, and embodied a nation as complex, unresolved, and revisionary as himself. Chapter 4. Domestic Rituals of Consumption. David Walker, a major black abolitionist figure, acknowledged the capacity of slavery to consume black bodies and souls. In Walker's appeal, Walker depicts a plantation reality where black men suffer emasculation. They can neither protect their wives and children, nor can they call themselves escape all the all-encompassing power of whites whose malicious hunger, Walker says, gnaws into our very vitals. Walker describes the consumptive process as fundamentally an attack on male potency and phallic assertion. They, the whites, know well if we are men, he says, and there is a secret monitor in their hearts which tells them we are. They know. I say, if we are men, and see them treating us in the manner they do, that there can be nothing in our hearts but death alone for them. To Walker's thinking, docile and acquiescing black men are more easily consumed. He advocates instead the virile, radical black male. This male, he predicts, will gut and violently overflow the consuming machine. 19th century black male abolitionists tended to agree with Walker. They felt that only male virility and a strong paternal role could save black people from social consumption. I noted in Chapter 3 how images of human consumption haunted Frederick Douglass. He described slavery as a living entity that wore robes already crimsoned with the blood of millions, and even now feasting itself greedily upon our own flesh. Everywhere Douglass turned, he saw slavery literally and psychically consuming black people. In the battle between Covey and Douglass, we get Douglass's version of black male might and gladiator-like potency winning out over the white male parasite determined to suck all vitality from the slave. Another black abolitionist, John S. Jacobs, described slave owners and traders as hungry heirs who partook daily of a feast of blood. Jacobs' most painful memories of slavery center upon his emasculated and socially consumed father. He writes, "To be a man and not be a man, a father without authority, a husband and no protector, is the darkest of fates. Such was the condition of my father, and such is the condition of every slave throughout the United States. He owns nothing. He can claim nothing. His wife is not his. His children are not his. They can be taken from him and sold any minute, as far away from each other as a human fleshmonger may see fit to carry them." White abolitionists documented incidents of black children literally boiled alive, butchered, and fed to open fires. They debated and deliberated about whether or not America was becoming a cannibal nation. Black men, though, as Jacob demonstrates, strove to convey the private effects of human consumption. By situating these factual and philosophical considerations in the context of their personal demise, black men demonstrated how the culture of consumption robbed them of their masculinity, destroyed familial units and ties, and portended the literal extinction of the race. Black men had good reason to worry about literal annihilation. Across the nation, whites predicted the extinction of and extermination of the Negro. For example, Midwestern economist George M. Weston predicted in 1857 that when the white artisans and farmers want the room which the African occupies, they will take it not by rude force, but by gentle and gradual and peaceful processes. The Negro will disappear. Others of the religious persuasion felt that an inherited capacity for Christian persuasion guaranteed the survival of the white race, and the lack of it condemned the Negro to extinction. Where whites foresaw and depicted clean and innocent processes of natural selection, black men saw bloodshed and gluttonous consumption. William Wells Brown described a man named Walker, a Negro speculator, who was amassing a fortune by trading in the bones, blood, and nerves of God's children. Solomon Northrup, a free black man illegally captured and sold into slavery, linked the gastronomical enjoyments of whites in their entitlement to processes of consumption that involve starving, raping, and emasculating slaves. In emphasizing black male virility and paternity, black men sought to counter this national death wish toward the Negro, which they experience as intrinsically tied to their social consumption. In this chapter, I want to complicate this idea of black male paternalism and radical insurgence as a final solution to social consumption, because what such an assertion tended to imply was that only radical paternal-type men could overcome or escape consumption. Along with radical black masculinity, black men emphasized traditional structures of the black family, reproduction, gender, and sexuality. As an example, the natural counterpart to the virile insurgent black father was the black mother, whom most conceived of as the mistress to and caretaker of black civilization. In response to slavery's habit of consuming black people in body and soul, David Walker advocates the restoration of black female maternity and reproductive power. The regeneration and sustenance of the race resides in mothers who bore the pains of death to give birth to us, and within wives who we love as we do ourselves. While this framing of the black male's social consumption was a useful uplift strategy, it limited then, and still does today, what we can know about the complex culture of consumption and the myriad ways black men resisted and grappled with the reality of their social consumption. The textual focus of this chapter is Harriet Jacobs' slave narrative, Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, written by herself. The narrative offers many examples of literal, psychic, and erotic consumption, from slaves whose flesh is literally cooked, to others fed alive to machines, to still others starved into sexual submission and erotically consumed by masters. Jacob depicts a shocking and haunting tableau of consumption and violence. Like her male contemporaries, Jacobs conceives of institutionalized consumption as a process that erodes familial ties, makes black men into heathens and brutes, violates black female chastity, and is antithetical to the Black Uplift Project. For her, the natural antidote to the culture of consumption she graphically depicts is black male virility, intelligence, and uplift spirit. In the narrative, men such as John Jacobs, her brother, Peter, a man who helps her escape, and her embattled father fulfill this role. She frequently refers to these men as intelligent, enterprising, and noble-hearted. These men form a natural complement to the black maternal politics informing the narrative. It does not matter that she never successfully couples with a black man, that her father's loss of his wife contributes to his death, or that men must suffer torture and death to secure only a few fleeting moments with wives and children. Such tragic losses underscore how slavery isolates loved ones from one another and makes individuals vulnerable, through the disruption of male-female conjugal unions and familial support systems, to processes of social consumption. Jacobs structures her uplift politics around stereotypic 19th century dyads of thought and experience, the most central dyad being the black maternal figure and the insurgent or suffering patriarch. On one hand, this central male-female pairing, its outgrowths, male virility, sacrificing maternity, safety familial union, chastity racial continuity, enabled a politics of black survival. And on the other hand, this rigid male/female dynamic prevented access to deeper realities of black male experience, to black erotic life, and to a fuller range of black male survival strategies within a culture of consumption. Someone like Luke, a slave Jacobs depicts as sexually brutalized and socially consumed, has nothing in Jacob's presentation of him to do with racial uplift, with an ennobled 19th century black masculinity, or with black female sexual politics under slavery. Luke does not fit into the traditional male/female dynamic because he does not affect outright resistance. He is subject to his master's homoerotic desires. He registers as sexually ambiguous, and he undergoes a sustained and ritualized process of social consumption. According to the prevailing 19th century discourse of manhood, Luke is not a man. And if we go along with Jacob's interpretation of his life and circumstances of consumption, we can easily write him off as a casualty of white hunger and appetite. In making Luke one of the focal figures in this chapter, I intend to argue the opposite of Jacob's presumptions. I feel that Luke is a different type of representative black man who, because he does not fit neatly into prevailing gender and sexual dynamics, offers a non-conforming and complicated understanding of black male sensibility that we do not get from those black men who have come to us through history as representative race men. Rather than presuming that he is simply an example of emasculation and white parasitism, I ask exactly how Luke qualifies as a man and in what ways his gender and sexual variance necessitate a more complicated understanding of black masculinity in the 19th century. Furthermore, going against the 19th century logic of the black paternal and maternal pairing, I draw numerous parallels between the lives of Luke and Jacobs. Jacobs also experienced homoerotic abuse at the hands of her mistress and had experiences that did not conform to norms of gender and sex. When we look at Jacob and Luke relationally, we get a different picture of black maternity and crucial dimensions of black female sexuality that we have tended to overlook or misrecognize come into focus. In the conclusion of the chapter, I theorize on the largely under-theorized topics of gender and sexual variance in the context of slavery. Drawing mostly upon black feminist scholarship, which has undertaken to correct narratives of black people as lacking gender and sexual identities under slavery, I challenge us to rethink the theoretical and material potential of transgenderism, gender variance, and sexual fluidity in terms of black cultural production. These fluid categories of sex and gender, I argue, are crucial to formulating a deeper, more complicated understanding of black interior life and black political praxis generated in the 19th century.
And that is where we will end the first audio segment. So we will pick up their second audio segment. We're almost at the subheading, Deciphering Black Male Rape. It's almost where we are picking up. In fact, I think that's where we're supposed to pick up for the second segment. I'll finish that last chapter because I think that is where we're supposed to pick up for the second audio segment. So the last paragraph. Furthermore, going against the 19th century logic of the black paternal and maternal pairing, I draw numerous parallels between the lives of Luke and Jacobs. Jacobs also experienced homoerotic abuse at the hands of her mistress and had experiences that did not conform to norms of gender and sex. When we look at Jacobs and Luke relationally, we get a different picture of black maternity and crucial dimensions of black female sexuality that we have tended to overlook or misrecognize come into focus. In the conclusion of this chapter, I theorize on the largely under-theorized topics of gender and sexual variance in the context of slavery, drawing mostly on black feminist scholarship, which is undertaken. I don't look like we were at a different spot. I thought we ended someplace that we didn't. My apologies. So we are picking up. We'll be right there. I thought we just missed that paragraph. But deciphering black male rape, that's what we're picking up at for the second audio segment. If you have commentary that you would like to share on Mr. Woodard's Delectable Negro, the number to dial is 641-715-3640. And the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. That number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. If you do not want to use your phone to dial in, you can use the free VOPE line. That number, or excuse me, the link, it's listed at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the link, it is tinyty.cc/1race. That is the number 1. Address again, tinyty.cc/1race. And that is the number 1. When you click that link, look on the left of the page. You'll see the link for the free VOPE line. Click it. It will open a small window on your screen. The top line is a drop-down menu. Click the number that I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. The next line, it will ask for the code. That code again is 564-943. Final line, it will ask for a name. You can put in your real name. You can click random keys. You can use a nickname, whatever you're comfortable with. Once you get all that information entered, click the green button at the bottom. It will connect you to the live program. It is the same procedure. If you would like to participate, you'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press star 6. You'll hear an audio prompt to press the number 1, and we'll get you on the line. We are a little bit more than halfway through the book, closing in on the conclusion. So folks, I want to be thinking of major themes, what you've learned, just what we have discussed thus far. You can have that in mind and share as we go. Folks who dialed in who have a hand up, line should be open. Please do not wait till the last minute. If you have commentary you would like to share, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus, and the rest of the callers and the listeners on the line, Rob in Milwaukee. Got a little late start. I was listening to the audio, but I wasn't in front of the text. But from what I heard, Frederick Douglass sounded quote-unquote gay. And I don't know if I'm in error. Maybe someone else can help me out with that, if I was hearing that correctly. I did have one thing that stood out, and then I had one question about the text. I'll start with what stood out, and that is on page 130. And it reads, we'll start with one, it's two things. One, I'll start with 128. When the white artisans and farmers want the room which the African occupies, they will take it not by rude force, but by gentle and gradual and peaceful processes. That really stood out. I think that is still the preferred method today. brings to mind what Nellie Fuller says, deceit and or brute force. And the next thing that stood out is on page 130. And which was along with Jacob's interpretation of his life and circumstances of consumption, we can't easily write him off as a casualty of white hunger and appetite. And that stood out to me because when it said write him off, it puts me in the mind frame of slavery was sanctioned by the state, which was laws, words on paper. And when I was sentenced, everything was in writing. And it seems as though black people are still being wrote off today. And the question that I have is on 128. Give me one second. 122. And it reads, a northern white man who feels compelled to stop descends from his horse and listens well, whom we might also think of listens well. We learn, had long desired to sound the mysterious depths of thoughts and feelings of a slave. As his eye catches hold of Madison in the shadows, he trembles with terror and excitement. Washington prayer titillates Listwell, who receives his remonstrations as a type of erotic climax. He did not have to wait long. There came another gush from the same full fountain, now bitter and now sweet. Afterward, Washington takes on a glow to his countenance and teems with the hope of freedom that seemed to sweeten the bitter cup of slavery. Now, man, that boggled my mind when I first heard it, and that's why I made a note of it. And my question is this part of the text, is this what Frederick Douglass was writing? Was that in his story? And the second question, is that describing a anti-sexual act? And thank you. I'm in my line.
I guess to the first part of the question, in terms of is this something that Frederick Douglass wrote, he says this is from The Heroic Slave. Now, I haven't read that, but he says this is from The Heroic Slave, the portions that he has in quotes here. He did not have to wait long. There came another gush, but all that's in quotes. So I can't imagine someone lying. Like, that's a pretty big lie. And then to have other people, Dr. Curry and other folks, read it and not say, hey, wait a minute, you know, he didn't write that, or you're falsely attributing quotes. Like, I would think, so this book has been out for 3 years now, so I would think someone would have seen if he was making that up. At least at this point, I don't have any reason to think that Frederick Douglass did not write this in The Heroic Slave. If somebody wants to, somebody can get a hand, I'll try myself to see if I can get a hand on The Heroic Slave and verify that that is in fact there. Lots of metaphors, so that would be another one open to interpretation in terms of what you think about what was written. That would be my response to that question. Other folks that are with us on the line that we have not heard from, if you have your own commentary, if you want to include your responses to Robin Wisconsin, his questions as well, that's fine also. But thank you, Rob. Other folks who have commentary, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Gus. Greetings to you, to Rob, and the other callers and listeners. what I got from the text in the beginning, in my first reading of it, was not necessarily that Frederick Douglass was homosexual, but that he was being homosexualized. And I think because Mr. Woodard is a gay male, he, in some parts of this writing, is homosexualizing Frederick Douglass, because the way that the system was functioning back then, there was no room for him to have any other types of relations besides those that white people allowed him to have. So it may not have been necessarily that he was homosexual, but the fact that that was the only form of, or option for him in order to gain any sort of sexual pleasure. It's no different than being in prison and then you're not necessarily a gay male, but because you're trapped in jail with men, with nothing but men for 10 years, you might give in to give in to those overt male sexual urges that express themselves in the form of a homosexual tryst or something of that, and even raping another black male. But and it's because of the context of what your life situation is. And I just think because Mr. Woodard was a gay male that he used maybe some of this information regarding the emasculation of Frederick Douglass to further effeminize him, in my opinion. On page 124, he writes something interesting. He says, "Yet the idea of Douglass as fecund and the image of another of the male mother suggests that things were not quite so simple. The image of the male mother is a syncretic figure that adds up ultimately to more than the sum of its parts. For example, while the male mother is a new emblem of the nation, it is also a deeply personal metaphor for Douglass, who him/herself gives birth to this symbol of the new. The male mother is a coded representation of the ways that male-male relations for Douglass took form from a fluid sense of gender and the consistent goal of whites to make the male slave into an effeminate relational object." And this speaks to what I was talking about as far as the author or his editors homosexualizing Frederick Douglass. Because when he says, "While the male mother is a new emblem of the nation, it is also a deeply personal metaphor for Douglass." Now, how does he know that? He's not Douglass. He's implying that. "Who him/herself gives birth to this symbol of the new." So he's now effeminizing Frederick Douglass by saying him/herself. And what is the new that he's giving birth to? It's the fact that he's being brutalized and raped and terrorized by white people, and they're turning him into the new. It's not something that he holistically embraced. It's something that he was forced to do. And then he says, "The male mother is a coded representation of the ways that male-male relations for Douglass took form from a fluid sense of gender and the consistent goal of whites to make the male slave into an effeminate relational object." So how does he know that Frederick Douglass had a fluid sense of gender? He's propagating something that I'm not familiar with whatsoever. And what he's accurate with is the consistent goal of whites, i.e. the white male, to make the male slave into an effeminate relational object. So he's being homosexualized by white people, and in parts of this text, I believe he's being homosexualized by the author. A little bit further down, on page 125, he says, "I'm advocating that our newer scholarship on Douglass integrate and apply the complex vision we now have of his person and contribution. We should see him as simultaneously a heroic male, a male daughter, a fecund, birth-giving male, a male child who was raped, a striving and self-serving patriarch, and an ennobled father of black letters and liberation. If I had to choose a more central motivation fueling these multiple overlapping and intersecting identities, I would choose hunger over and beyond reason, falling back upon the female genealogy of hunger and consumption evinced in Douglass's material relations and in his own embodied feminine sensibilities. Hunger, as I'm thinking of it, is a logical reasoning and strategic. It is also embodied, sensate, and intuitive. Hunger is a mediating alchemical ground, a point from which Douglass consistently translated what was felt and desired into reasoned action, rhetorical performance, and civic belonging, as problematic as this always was. It is out of Douglass's hunger and in response to forces that threatened to consume him that he dreamed, envisioned, and embodied a nation as a complex, unresolved, and revisionary as himself." And again, he's making a suggestion to the reader that we should see him as a male daughter. Who made him a male daughter? the white guy who enslaved him and was raping him ad infinitum. What is he giving birth to? Because he said he's a birth-giving male. Men don't give birth at all. The only thing that he could give birth to is the revolutionary ideas and concepts that will give birth to other black males who want to follow in his footsteps and replace white supremacy with justice. Outside of that context, men don't give birth. So that is another form of homosexualizing of the ancestor Frederick Douglass. And then he wrote, let me see, and he said, if I had to choose a more central motivation fueling these multiple overlapping and intersecting identities, I would choose hunger over and beyond reason. I think, and I based on what he's writing, I go the opposite. He's reasoning that since he's in a situation where he's being forced to be hungry and basically to consume himself in certain aspects, and also because he's forced to allow himself to be consumed by his enemy, that he is making reasoned decisions based on the circumstances in which he finds himself, not the other way around. That is my reason for why I think he was potentially homosexual, but he has been, and in certain aspects, being homosexualized in the text. On 128, the author writes, to be a man and not to be a man, a father without authority, a husband and no protector, is the darkest of fates. Such was the condition of my father, and such is the condition of every slave throughout the United States. He owns nothing. He can claim nothing. His wife is not his. His children are not his. They can be taken from him and sold any minute, as far away from each other as the human flesh monger may see fit to carry them. I just find that to be one of the most important paragraphs in the whole text, just to put the context of the black experience in this country, especially the black male right now, in its proper context, because we're slaves right now. And everything that he described as far as the lack of agency that black men had in that time is the same lack of agency we have now. So I think that's something for us to really ponder upon in order to facilitate us thinking about how we're going to go about replacing this system with a system of justice immediately. Lastly, I just wanted to touch on page 130, and it goes into 131. The author writes, in making Luke one of the focal figures of this chapter, I intend to argue the opposite of Jacob's presumptions. I feel that Luke is a different type of representative black man who, because he does not fit neatly into prevailing gender and sexual dynamics, offers a non-conforming and complicated understanding of black male sensibility that we do not get from those black men who have come to us through history as representative race men. Rather than presuming that he is simply an example of emasculation and white parasitism, I ask exactly how Luke qualifies as a man and in what ways his gender and sexual variants necessitate a more complicated understanding of black masculinity in the 19th century. Furthermore, going against the 19th century logic of the black paternal and maternal pairing, I draw numerous parallels between the lives of Luke and Jacob's. Jacob's also experienced homoerotic abuse at the hands of her mistress and had experiences that did not conform to the norms of gender and sex. And again, I think he's presenting Luke, which I think is accurate in the sense that just because he might have been homosexual or homosexualized to the point of accepting his fate and maybe at some point embracing it, I'm not him, I don't know. But through that experience, again, he also had to deal with the situation that was before him and make adjustments to his lifestyle in order to survive and possibly probably not commit suicide by having himself being terrorized sexually on a regular basis. So just because he was homosexualized and being raped doesn't mean that he didn't want to fight the system in that super oppressed, emasculated state. So I agree with him on that particular point. And, because in the 19th century, black masculinity was forced to be fluid. So that is something for us to look into, whereas he's giving the impression that black males have always had this gender fluidity, which I know historically did not exist until we came into contact with whites and Arabs. So again, thanks for taking my call, and I'll meet my line and give someone the chance to speak. But I just think there's a lot of propagation of anti-sexual cultural and behavior and perspective. And I think that's just based on the fact that the author himself is a homosexual. And I think that's also part of the reason this book has gotten such praise from the LGBTQ community. Thank you. And I'll mute my line.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I felt the exact same way when I was catching up on the reading and I read the Frederick Douglass parts of the text. I felt that the author was overreaching and trying really, really hard to make connections that weren't necessarily there, which happens a lot in the institution and in so-called academia and stuff like that. They're always wanting to populate or postulate some type of theory. So sometimes, like, things should be simple and clear. And I was like, how is he even coming up with this? And and there was something else that, like, I noticed that there's, like, a theme in the book to be, I thought the book would be a little bit different than how it's coming off now after the Frederick Douglass part. I thought this would have a lot more stories of how Black men were consumed and homosexualized in slavery in many different situations all over the Americas and even beyond, you know, instead of taking one person and then, like, looking through the things that they've written or the things that they've said to try to pick out particular passages or words that you can kind of, like, twist. And another reason I think that the whole gay community or queer theory community would accept this book is because it does not mention it, like, very, very little white females' roles in that. And I thought this book would have it, because even though it's the white male who would be raping the Black male, there has to be stories and, like, accounts of what white females were doing to Black men and that power dynamic that would also further emasculate them. Just because you have sex with a woman, but if you didn't want to, it doesn't mean that you walk away feeling more manly. So, like, that's not mentioned in here at all. The author also goes to a great extent to focus on white males. I started just highlighting every time, just white male, white male, white male. It's never white people, white females. It's always just white male, white male, white male. Another thing that was a little bit off-putting in the text was this notion that a male, if he is not a male, is a female. And I think that that's dangerous. Women, females, are not males who lack penises. That's like a Freudian concept, and it's incorrect. Two distinct sexes or genders who are different. So an emasculated male is not a female, just like an empowered, or, you know, a woman who, like Harriet Tubman, would not be a masculine female, even though she was saying that, like, when she asked, ain't I a woman? I'm still a, like, they're different. And I felt like this author should have done that. But there's so much, like, becoming a daughter, biological females, the role of the female, the womb. I also was a little frustrated in the text too, when he says, because men don't give birth the way that women give birth, but men participate in creation. So the act of giving birth is different, but men participate in creating. So if a man is so-called birthing a nation, he's really just co-creating a nation or assisting. That whole umbrella of now Frederick Douglass is more feminine because he wanted to birth so-called this nation. I was like, but then if that's the case, then we would have to put that on white men who created the U.S. 13 colonies and the whole system of racism and supremacy as feminine because they created something. And I don't think that that's, like, I think that does a large injustice to males, Black men specifically too, because Black men have always been very creative. Like, to be creative is not to be feminine. I disagree with that. To be creative is to be human, and however you do it and the ways that it look are nuanced and different for the so-called sexes and genders. But I was like, what? That doesn't make any sense. So I was very frustrated with that. There was a couple other parts in the text. But some people have already, like, read them, so I'm not going to. But there was a couple parts on page 122. And I don't think that the author wrote this. This might be a quote from someone else. But seduction is the means to construct, this is at the bottom of page 122. Seduction is the means to constructing a new genealogy of American nativity based in the copulation of Black and white male. And I was like, how? I'm not even sure, you know, what does he mean by genealogy of American nativity? Like, sometimes some of these things are written and they're just, you can tell that they're, I feel like it's intentionally decisive in its confusion. Like, what is it that's being said? What are you trying to say? And it should be clear to understand. It shouldn't be so convoluted. And that's pretty much what I wanted to say, because that's starting to be my theme, that I think the book is trying to become one, like, not that the book itself is trying to, but maybe the author was trying to locate himself within in his own sexuality and find justification for it in other very prominent Black males who have written or spoken things, and try to place that in some type of historical context. And a lot of times that's what people do. You know, you write a book so it can become part of the literary canon. So then when other people conduct research, they can always refer back to this book and all the other books that will come. And now this becomes something that would be considered somewhat true. And I think this book is almost like that. I really thought it would be different, but that part on Frederick Douglass, I was just like, there's really no validation for that. That just seems the superfluous nature of the language at the time. That the way that people were speaking, I do understand when he did talk about Abraham's, you know, lips and stuff like that. But I don't think that makes him female or a daughter, or just because he envisioned a nation where he would be equal, that made him feminine. They're separate. So thank you.
Yes, ma'am. You heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to other callers, listeners. I agree with the last two callers. I think that a lot of the author's personal life is reflected in some of these, positions that he take on Frederick Douglass's life and what was going on in his head at the time. But when you take someone that had been through what he had been through, and to the point to where singing underneath the window of the slave mistress, and she throwing him pieces of bread or food, he thought that was kindness, you know, to the point that almost anything that anyone or a white person did could be looked upon as some, you know, way larger than what it really was at the time. And I don't think that the author is really painting an accurate picture. But to the book, I'm glad that Frederick Douglass, on page 118, he said that he was in a phase in his life when he believed in the proximity to Black nobility and empathy could change whites. He would realize, though, after finding out about Lincoln's support of the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, that Northern whites had used him and the enslaved persons' cause to further their nationalist and other political aims. And I just wanted to reiterate on that, because these abolitionists, or so-called abolitionists, was not interested in the welfare of the enslaved African. And I noticed that the author used the word emble a lot, over four or five times in this particular reading. And then the so-called emblem of the anti-slavery, the abolitionist, was a slave kneeled down, you know, mangled with chains, and with the wording, am I a man? You know, something to that effect. But the Freeman Saving Bank fiasco on page 120, a little bit about that is, I guess Black people after slavery, after emancipation, was getting together, getting their coins together and created banks. I think as many as maybe 37 banks have been created. And then the white people, of course, come along and come up with the idea of making a confederation or bringing them all in together under the terms of maybe protecting them. So they took all these banks and then mismanaged the funds. As a footnote on page on in the back of the book, 102, it explains a little bit more about it. Looks as though Frederick Douglass himself, well, they appointed him as president of this so-called Federation of Banks after they had stolen all the money, and the footnote was saying sadistic, you know, in a festival type manner. They squandered all the funds, hard work and savings of slaves, and just had a ball on that. And then one last thing, I believe that was in the heroic slave. I kind of discounted all this information that he come up with about a male mother and a union between white males and black males. But I like the part when they got on David Walker on the beginning of chapter 4. He said, Walker describes the consumptive process as fundamentally an attack on male potency and phallic assertion that they, the whites, know well if we are men, he says, and there is a secret monitor in their hearts which tell them we are. They know. I say, if we are men and see them treating us in this manner, they do, then there can be nothing in our hearts but death alone for them. To Walker's thinking, docile and acquiescent black men are more easily consumed. He advocated instead a vital, radical black male. This male, he predicts, will glut and violently overflow the consuming machine. And so I believe that a vital fight against the system of white supremacy is what's needed, and that I can see why the system would allow something like this to be published to try to tarnish the image of one of the nation and black icons and black American history. I'll mute my line. Thanks, God.
Appreciate that. If other folks that are listening in, if you have comments you would like to share, please do not wait till the last minute. Go ahead and get a hand up. We have 20 minutes or so before we get to the second audio segment. If you have other thoughts folks want to share. Before I get to some of my thoughts on the book this week, I think I mentioned way back when we first got started with this text that it's in so many different books that during castrations where they where they mutilated black bodies and they would cut away body parts. And I said that I had read about a lynching where they cut away some of the body parts and you had some cannibalism and auto cannibalism happening. One of the listeners, I think I just read a little bit from memory one of the times that I read this, and they said, oh, that's in The Warmth of Other Suns. And lo and behold, it is. So they're talking about the lynching of Claude Neal. This is a infamous case that happened down in Florida in the 1930s. So the lovely Isabel Wilkerson, she writes, well before the appointed hour, several thousand people had gathered at the lynching site. The crowd grew so large and unruly, people having been given sufficient forewarning to come in from other states, that the committee of six, fearing a riot, took Neal to the woods by the Chipola River to wait out the crowds and torture him before the execution. There, his captors took knives and castrated him in the woods. Then they made him eat the severed body parts and say he liked it, a witness said. One man threw up at the sight, wrote the historian James R. McGovern. I'll stop there again. This is in Isabel Wilkerson's The Warmth of Other Suns, which we also read on the book club way, 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 way back, 2013. It's in the chapter George Swanson Starling. And I think this is not the only time that I've read. They call this, the fancy word is auto-cannibalism. In this instance, this victim, a black male being forced to eat his own genitalia, right in line with Delectable Negro. All right, so back to this text, some of the things that stood out that I highlighted for this week. The portion, I think right at the beginning of where we picked up at this week, this is still in chapter 3, where they're talking about Douglass's admiration of Lincoln. I think this is right where we ended at last week, and then he picks up with that this week, where he says, it is something of the slave in Douglass, the one who has had to constantly battle for freedom and a place to rest, who sees finally in Lincoln the maternal bosom, an emblem of a final resting place. He relates to Lincoln as a romanticizing male child, a male to female romantic object. And again, now he's already, this is the paragraph after he's already got in quotes now, where Douglass is talking about the president's lips and his face, and you know, he looks like just such a great guy. And he's, you know, going into great detail, talking about his eyes and the tenderness of motherhood in his eyes, and his mouth and other features had the highest perfection of genuine manhood. This is all in quotes. Reading those statements and then reading his assessment just in that paragraph about how he views Lincoln in the context of being enslaved, terrorized, perhaps raped or subjected to some form of homosexual violence while he was enslaved, it makes total sense in that vein to view Lincoln or any white person, male or female, in that manner. In, oh my gosh, I hope that I can connect with this white person and they will, you know, they will be able to keep me safe and look out for me. Particularly when he gives the same anecdote a little bit further down. I'm going a little bit out of order, but it reminds me of the same thing when he talks about it's right there. It's right in order. I was going to say, yeah, when he talks about this incident that happened on the train with Edward Marshall, where he says Marshall, where I guess they came like, oh, this Negro, you know, Frederick, I don't care what your name is, Frederick Douglass, get off the train. So they go to throw him off the train. And he says, the captain orders Douglass to be physically removed from the dining room. Marshall rebuffs the steward with eyes full of fire. Douglass sees a lightning flash and imagines this saving individual as a deity of the sky with golden hair and fiery eyes, whose voice resounded like a clap of summer thunder. In this instance, Douglass casts himself in the more effeminate role, describing Marshall as chivalrous, gallant, and possessed of generous and manly qualities. In my view, it's the same thing. And I think this is the one where they tie in the fact that Marshall, I guess, just visited his black mammy. So maybe he was feeling especially connected and sympathetic to Negroes on that particular day to stick up for Douglass. But I just, in that environment, whether we're talking 19th century or right now, it's very, very easy for any black person, when your very life can be taken at any moment. Whew, if there is a white person who is willing to stick up for me and will keep me safe, hey, I'm going to stick. This will be the coolest white person ever. I think many, many victims of racism end up functioning in that manner. And in my view, I think the most accurate way of reading that is not that, oh, you know, maybe he was transgender or had, you know, fluidity with regards to his sexual identification. It is, that is the system of white supremacy. And that is what it is designed to do, to put us in that inferior, emasculinized state, where we are constantly looking for the man, the woman to keep us safe, and that would be white man, white woman. Next, it comes up again. I think all of these responses where later on, where he quotes Douglass, where he says slaves were Mr. Freeland belongs to the class of slaveholder admired and affectionately thought of by slaves. Slaves were not, Douglass notes, insensible to the whole souled qualities of a generous, dashing slaveholder who was fearless of consequences, and they preferred a master of this bold and daring kind, even with the risk of being shot down for impudence. And this is no longer quotes, this is the author, Mr. Woodard, and the editors. Following this logic of aristocratic refinement, one can understand how Douglass found in Lincoln the perfect embodiment of the ennobled father figure. I think there's that word again. Where I guess I would present maybe three quick thoughts on this. Number one, I think we talked before, Douglas writing, speaking to a lot of white audiences, racist audiences. There could be some level of, I think whites would like to hear this sort of thing. I'll write that. I think that could be a possibility. I think, too, repeating the same thing that I said before, the system of white supremacy, you're going to have a variety of these types of responses where you have victims of racism where whether I eat, whether I live, whether I get to keep my child is dependent upon how this individual white person, male or female, feels about me. It can and does. Is designed to inspire all of these types of thoughts, whether it's overwhelming awe, attraction, fear, all at the same time, just because of the power that they wield over our lives. Again, in my view, I think it just comes down to how do you read all this? Is this a response to racism, white supremacy, or does this speak more about, you know, our fluid understanding of gender and sexual identity? Let's see. The next portion where he says that, that's why I included that, where later on, this is on at the bottom of 122, where he says, Douglas scripts a homoerotic interchange that is mutually beneficial. According to P. Gabriel Foreman, at the time that Douglas pens this story, he is acutely aware that white men are the only reader citizens imbued with legal standing as witnesses. They are his only politically embodied readers, the only ones, that is, with a vote. So as a way of harnessing this political power, Douglas attempts to seduce white male readers. Now, that last sentence is in quotes. That's from this Foreman person. I don't know if this is a white person or non-white person. He's talking about the fiction work, The Heroic Slave, that Douglas wrote. I did find a copy online. I guess if you want to print it out or read it online, The Heroic Slave, it is available. And if what I saw online is accurate, the portions that are quoted in this text I think Robin Wisconsin asked about, that's in the text online that is reportedly written, the version that was written by Frederick Douglass. So it looks like he did say the things that are attributed to him in this portion of the text this week. Just my view, again, number one, I think it's worth considering that Douglass could have been, as they say, wearing the mask. Smart enough to figure out this is the sort of thing that white people would want to consume. And apparently a number of black people have figured out something in that manner that, hey, white people are much more accepting of an effeminate black person. However that can be packaged, that might be something that I can use to my advantage. And again, I think he states repeatedly throughout the text that that is one of the goals, is to effeminize black males. So I think some black people, period, but to effeminize black males. So I think sometimes it's just looking, is this what we're looking at, the result of what white people have done and the goal that they hope to achieve? Is this something where victims of racism, as they say, are wearing the mask? We know what needs to be done in terms of just trying to keep ourselves as safe as we can. So if that means I'll speak in a high-pitched voice, reminding me of Little Richard or whatever I need to do to get these white people to maybe not terrorize me quite so much, I think that's something to think about as well. Maybe Mr. Woodard is correct and we just haven't understood things correctly. Folks can process that way as well. Continuing... Let's see. Anything else I want to make sure I get in? I do think he calls it mother hunger. I think we talked about that last week. I do think that is significant. There was just the report at NPR this week where they were talking about efforts of enslaved black people, where they were taking out ads in the paper and just going through really, really like just extraordinary efforts to find lost black people, that family and those connections with people that we cared about meant so much that they just went through extraordinary efforts, walking miles and miles and miles at a time where you didn't have sidewalks and shoes even readily available in roads and what have you to find other black people. So I do think that mother hunger is real. Just in my opinion, some of the things that you all have already touched on, I agree with, where I think that gets distorted and misrepresented as some sort of his mother hunger being displaced to his homoerotic feelings for other white men in positions of power. To me, that just does not seem reasonable. To me, that seems like a lot of the 21st century white supremacy ideology, where they're really pushing all of this sexual confusion, and particularly when it's time to talk about racism. Now, we really want to make sure that we mandatorily include that in all dialogue to just further confound our understanding of racism, white supremacy. Could be the case here. I could be in error. Let's see. The point I think Roz already touched on, where Woodard and the editors, where they say, we should see Douglas as a heroic male, a male daughter, birth-giving male. Some of these, I don't know if they're speaking metaphorically, if they're speaking in a literal sense. To my mind, it is not possible for males biologically to give birth. Now, if we're talking about a metaphor of some sort, then that would be on the author in terms of what you think he is, quote-unquote, giving birth to. I think Ross said, is it revolutionary ideas about black liberation, or what exactly are we talking about? I think a lot of this, as you all have stated, just could be us looking to run with our agenda, and we'll find ways of attributing these ways of thinking to Douglas, even though this is just our current racist ideology of what we're trying to promote, in ways we're trying to confuse people to pick up our concepts about all this deviant sexual behavior. Let's see. I think it was Mr. Demery Ford. I thought that was really important, where he touched on Frederick Douglass being duped by some of these whites up north, where they just wanted to control and manipulate him. I thought that was really important. Glad that we got that emphasized. I also thought it was significant. He mentioned the footnote where they were talking about the Freedmen's Bank. And I think that footnote included that they put, I think, as Mr. Demery Ford said, they put Frederick Douglass in charge at the end after the whites had already stolen and looted all this money. They put Frederick Douglass at the in charge at the end and be like, oh, man, no good. Fred ran off with all the money. You can't trust niggas at all. See, we told that's literally in the footnote. I'm just paraphrasing, but that's exactly what they say in the footnote at the end, that they put him there just to take all of the blame so he'd be the one to get in trouble. They've been doing the racial showcasing successfully for a long, long time. Final thing I'll get in, then we can check, see if folks have anything else that they would like to share. Let's see. I was going to say something about the things that came up in the second. I guess the patriarch, because that came up as well. I reject that now. We just had that conference with Professor Matua. She was Athena Matua. She was on the program in December 2016, and she posited that. I think they ended right at, towards the end, saying that Frederick Douglass was a quote-unquote patriarch. I emphatically reject that then. I reject that now. You cannot be a victim of white supremacy and a patriarch, a matriarch, a member of the syndicate, or anything else. If you are a victim of white supremacy, that is your title, and you are not in charge, nor do you have the power to do anything other than maybe get on some other victim's nerves. And even that, white people can probably stop that in about 5 seconds if they really want to. I'll stop there. Other folks have anything that they would like to share, comments they'd like to make before we get to the second audio segment?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Congrats for the opportunity to speak again. You made some salient points, and I have to say, big up to Mr. Demery Ford. He just said some incredible things. And what was interesting about what Mr. Demery said was when he was discussing about the propagation of homosexuality amongst the slaves. And from my studies, what I've determined is that is the reason that they homosexually rape black males. And that's why they did it to all the other people who they conquered, is because if you homosexualize your enemy, then in the white mind, I think it takes away the threat of masculine violence. So in other words, if you have men who are able to function as men in the true capacity in which nature created men to act, they feel more threatened by that in regards to those men rising up against them. Whereas if they effeminize them, emasculate and rape and homosexualize them, they feel that they've effeminized the masculine out of them. So there's less of a physical threat of violence from that homosexualized victim that they've now conquered. That's what my studies have shown. And I think it was 909, if I remember correctly, he had talked about a book that it was called the quarrel between poetry and philosophy. And in that particular text, they discuss how white people have codified their homosexual rape of black men just for that purpose. So it's something people might want to look into. And the other thing I wanted to bring up was the section that you read from the Warmth of Other Suns kind of speaks to what I call the homosexualization of the ancestor Frederick Douglass, because when you read the fact that they actually cut off his genitals, forced him to eat them, and then and other body parts that they cut off from him, and then also say that he liked it before they killed him, that would be like the author saying that because he ate his own genitals and ate the other body parts, that he really liked auto-cannibalism. So to me, it's the same way of blaming the ancestor Frederick Douglass for being in a situation that is not of his making. He's being coerced and violently terrorized into thinking and being, thinking and forced to participate in deviant sexual behavior. And we're now blaming him for it or attempting to homosexualize him as if he did this willingly and that he had the agency to make this decision on his own. Thank you. And I'll meet my line.
All right. Folks have any other comments that they wanted to make sure they got in before we move forward?
I'd like to say one last thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It says on page 120, Frederick Douglass was beginning to realize an interconnection between the rebirth of the nation and the personal rebirth. Douglass broke from white abolitionists in opposition to predominant abolitionist views. Douglass became convinced that there was no necessity for dissolving the union between the North and the Southern states. And then later on, he made a point for slavery itself being unconstitutional. And I thought that was interesting. I'll mute my line.
Any other commentary folks want to make sure they get in? I know one thing that stood out for me in reading this section is this reminded me of some of the different books that I've read from white authors over the years, where they will have constructive information within the text, but there will also be a lot of instances where it's like, I suspect that they are practicing racism, and you kind of have to use your brain computer to make choices about what you think is constructive information. I think this is valid. I think this is something that I can, interrogate, investigate a little more, and use moving forward. This is something that I don't think is valid, that I think, in whichever way is practicing supporting racism, white supremacy, and I'm going to discard, and or I'm just going to make sure that I tag this as an example of racism, and then maybe I'll use it in the future as to how this is, one of the ways that racism is practiced, so I can use it and deconstruct it to other victims. I guess what would be your response if anyone said, well, hey, I think some of you all at least have said, hey, I think Woodard and the editors, I think they got it right about the sexual abuse, homosexual abuse that Frederick Douglass may have been subjected to, and him going through and decoding that and saying that, hey, I think this is there, and this was more widespread than we've been led to believe. He says that last week, we accept that. How do you come back this week and say, well, hey, I reject. I think, that he is just trying to insert his own politics and maybe even look for his own identity in some of the narrative that he's constructed here. And all of this about Frederick Douglass being a male daughter and him having this fluidity in gender. And he didn't see himself in this as a staunch example of black masculinity because of his experiences. What would you say to people who say, well, hey, you all accepted what they had to say last week about the interpretation, then you come back this week and reject some of the exact same commentary related to the exact same person, Frederick Douglass? How can you do that? What would your response be?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I wouldn't argue with a black person, VGQ, with a white person, whatever. But The difference for me between last week's reading and this week's reading was last week's reading focused on opening up his narrative to find the spaces where he was perhaps having a double consciousness and speaking in code. The text says that he would always speak in code and others would always speak in code. So what stuck out to me about last week's reading was moments where we saw Frederick Douglass more as a vulnerable human being, a vulnerable Black male, in situations where he would be taken advantage of sexually by these white men in the situations that he was in. And so that's why I was like, well, that absolutely makes sense, because sometimes the conversation around black male rape specifically doesn't happen. So unless it's something that we are saying, this is what is possible is happening here, we're not going to actually read into that many times. So that's what I appreciated about last week. This week, I was able to see where maybe the author said, or whoever edited this text after the author passed, or however this happened, used that preliminary part to make overarching assumptions about Frederick Douglass's nature, gender, and to make to derive conclusions that are really, they wouldn't be admissible in court. You're making you're just making it up. We don't really know. Now, Frederick Douglass, someplace in his text says, look, I enjoy having sex with men or something like that, then okay, then maybe. But to be looking and making these, they're just conclusions off of really nothing. And I didn't appreciate that. Before, we're using what Frederick Douglass said and saying, well, that would make sense in the context of racism, white supremacy, in the context of slavery. He was an enslaved person. He does talk about this rape, what that must have been like. So we're made to sympathize, empathize, and really put him in context versus being Frederick Douglass, the icon. This one, he tore it down and just pretty much was like, well, he's a male daughter and like all these other things that I couldn't necessarily, logically seem to push an end versus being specific and clarifying a person. If that makes any sense. That's what I would say.
We got time for maybe one more response before we get to the second audio. Anybody else want to respond if the question I pose makes sense?
Can I be heard?
I'll be heard.
Heard both Rob in Wisconsin and Roz. Let's see. We'll get Rob in Wisconsin.
Okay. Really quickly, last week I remember asking the question, was Frederick Douglass right? So I think that last week he alluded to it. This week it was blatant. He told you what happened. And I think that Frederick Douglass was really feminized this week. And I'm not quite clear on if the author is really pushing an agenda or not. And I'm not clear because of the anti-sexual subject. It's just confusing for me. Thank you.
Roz, you want to respond briefly before we get to the second audio?
Sure. Yes. Thank you. I disagree. I agree with Emmy, and in the sense that everything this week is more taken out of context. It's much more opinionated, and it's much more centered on, to me, the power of suggestion. Because for either the author or the editors to write stuff like we have to see him as a male mother and things of that nature, they're suggesting that we go into this mindset, which is something that white supremacists do. And even if Frederick Douglass came out and said, yes, I like to have sex with men, he was psychosexually, socially conditioned to do so within the context of the slave situation that he found himself in. So who's to say that he was really gay if he was to come out and say that in the context of you being raped and being forced to accept this particular modality of living on a sexual level, simply because the people in power are forcing you to do so. And with anybody else who's been oppressed and abused and terrorized, eventually, if you think that your situation will never change for the rest of your life, you're going to be in this situation, at some point you're going to psychologically amalgamate and acclimate yourself to that life and say, this is the life I'm left to live. Now I have to try and get in where I fit in, because this is not going to change before I close my eyes permanently. And these are the contexts that we have to see this stuff in, so that we don't, like you said earlier, walk into looking at an ancestral slave situation with modern racist anti-sexual sensibilities. Thank you.
Right on. We will leave it there. We will pick up where we left off. So we are chapter four, kind of the early portion of chapter four, deciphering black male rape, is where we left off at. If you have questions that pertain to what we just finished reading and you didn't get to share your comments, just make a note, and we should have ample time to share once the second audio segment concludes. This is Vincent Woodard, the Delectable Negro, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number two.
Deciphering Black Male Rape. On the subject of parallels and pairings, I want to begin my discussion of Luke by drawing our attention to a common and consistently invoked 19th century pairing. I am thinking of the dialectic between the liberated, freedom-seeking black man and the so-called slave. As noted earlier, David Walker consistently grounds his rhetorical claims to manhood in the dynamic of man versus brutish slave. Speaking to enslaved brethren, he asks, "Are we men?" And then later affirms that we are men and not brutes. Elsewhere in Walker's appeal, he proclaims, "Oh, my colored brethren all over the world, when shall we arise from this death-like apathy and be men?" The natural counterpoint to Walker's appeal to manhood is the slave. Rhetorically speaking, without the slave, there could be no liberated black man, as they each mutually defined and demarcated the threshold of the other. In terms of consumption, Walker regarded the slave as a natural byproduct of the culture of consumption. Like slabs of meat, slaves are made through acts of butchering and murdering, their flesh seasoned and tendered through cruel acts of self-consumption. Walker describes how a son might take his mother, who bore almost the pains of death to give him birth, and by the command of a tyrant, strip her naked as she came into the world and apply the cowhide to her. Such initiatory acts make a man into a slave, according to Walker, and render him vulnerable to the compulsive urges of whites who gorge and satiate themselves upon such twisted acts of violence. Walker's conception of man versus slave reflected general abolitionist thought. A popular abolitionist image conveys this dialectic. The widely used anti-slavery emblem was a manacled slave kneeling in supplication. The caption to this image read, "Am I not a man and brother? How could a man be both manly and a slave?" argued abolitionists, who believed that slavery unmanned and systematically consumed black men. Black activist Maria W. Stewart, speaking before a group of black Bostonians in 1831, admonished, "O ye fearful ones, throw off your fearfulness. If you are men, convince whites that you possess the spirit of men." To Stewart's thinking, real black men overcame their fears and were assertive in the world, acting as brave sons of Africa, able to draw upon their noble heritage. Whereas Africa signified under slavery heathenism and the loss of a cultural legacy, manhood makes possible the transformation of even Africa into a noble and enlivening landscape. The general tide in abolitionist rhetoric was towards manhood and away from a deeper, more complicated meaning of the slave. For example, in his bold assertions of black manhood, Walker countered Thomas Jefferson's ideas of the black slave as heathen, akin to the orangutan, and in reason, much inferior to the white man. Walker does not complicate the reality of slave experience by exploring how a man could be a man and also be sexually violated and lacking in paternal authority or, for that matter, a slave and also a noble and reasoning human being. Instead, he relies upon a dichotomy wherein manhood transcends all of the negative, unseemly connotations of enslavement, in consistently positioning manhood over slave status. Black abolitionists tend to reinforce a false dichotomy in which manhood always represented the good and discerning path towards freedom. The condition of the slave, on the other hand, embodied the most depraved and unspeakable acts of black experience. Douglass gives us an example of these unspeakable dimensions of slave experience in his first slave narrative. After witnessing the brutal beating of his Aunt Hester, Douglass lets on that this is not the worst what he will see or what he will be forced to participate in. He has not words, he says, to describe the sensations and awarenesses that accompanies his brutal initiation. It was the first of a long series of such outrages of which I was doomed to be a witness and a participant. It struck me with awful force. It was the most awful spectacle. I wish I could commit to paper the feelings with which I beheld it. Douglass never describes this scenario, which recurs in his latter narratives in graphic detail. Nor do we ever glean from Douglass's other published writings deeper insight into the secret, unspeakable world to which he refers. In Chapter 3, I demonstrated how the legacy and ontology of the slave carries over, continues beyond the temporal feeling of the freeing of the slave. I contend that it is the slave, in Douglass, who is essential to understanding the limitations, horizons, and potentials of the free and emancipated man. I reference this distinction between man and slave because it is crucial to understanding why Jacobs chose to narrate Luke's story of explicit male sexual violation in the first place. Jacob's narrative is, at least on the surface, a story about black female violation and the recuperative powers of motherhood. In the preface to the slave narrative, Jacob makes clear that she writes on behalf of the condition of 2 million of women at the South, still in bondage, suffering what I suffered, and most of them far worse. Black male sexual violation did not figure into Jacob's gender and sex politics, which might explain why scholars have had very little to say about Luke or why Jacobs chose to tell his story. For the most part, scholars of Jacob's narrative have either ignored the subject of male rape or misrecognized it. P. Gabriel Forman refers to Luke as a rare example of homosexual abuse to which male narrators rarely, if ever, admit, but does not himself analyze the import and significance of Luke to the larger narrative. And Bradford Warner cites Luke as a terse example of slave vernacular, making no reference to his sexual treatment. Jean Fagan Yellen, the preeminent Jacob's biographer, painstakingly tracks down all manner of minute detail and historical fact from Jacob's narrative, but leaves untouched the subject of male rape and the broader implications of homoeroticism on the plantation. Maurice Wallace offers the most insightful understanding of Luke and sodomy belief of the time period. Luke's master suffers, according to Jacobs, from excessive dissipation. Wallace traces this malady to the medical science of the period. Excessive dissipation and palsy were the consequences of sexual perversions, including masturbation and sodomy, for which the usual prognosis was progressive dementia. Using the terminology of the time period, Wallace helps us understand how Jacob's reading of Luke's master as demented and sexually strange coincided with medical notions of sodomy as an illness of the mind and body. What Luke meant, though, as an outgrowth of his master's sexual illness has little to do with the politics of why Jacobs chose to tell his story. Two centuries early, a New Netherland court executed Jan Purley for committing sodomy upon the body of Manuel Congo. The court defined both Purley and Congo as sodomites, black sodomites. The reason their stories were told had to with the preservation of Christian morals and values. Both blacks were condemned of God and as an abomination. Elsewhere in the colonies, separate sodomy legislation for blacks would affirm how, in the minds of whites, the black sodomite was a natural outgrowth of African heathenism and an innate immorality. We cannot separate a sexual interpretation of Crilly, Congo, or Luke from larger institutionalized conceptions of the Negro as sexually licentious and amoral. The reason Jacobs chose to tell Luke's story would have differed greatly from the political aims of the Christian state. Yet I use this state example to demonstrate how moral, political, and state-making ideology inform the depiction of black sodomites or rape black men in the colonial United States. Questions of intentionality direct us to the political unity behind the colonial era depictions of black male homoeroticism. Jacob's motive in telling Luke's story takes on even greater import when we recall that black people on the whole did not write about male rape or homoeroticism. Of the hundreds of thousands of pages of narrative, testimony, recorded speeches, and liberationist tracts written by black men, we have yet to recover overt depictions of male rape or homoeroticism. For black women, such a topic was even more taboo, as it suggested sexual licentiousness and a knowledge of sexual matters that most women disavowed. Jacobs knew that these rhetorical slash sexual politics well. A master of rhetorical strategies, she single-handedly revisited the conventions of the slave narrative, the sentimental novel, and the uplift tract to construct a unique and singular document about black female liberation and womanhood under slavery. For such a woman, the telling of Luke's story had a profound political import that we can access only partially through sexual interpretations of his master and his treatment under his master. Thinking of Jacob's intentionality in terms of the man-slave dialectic, Jacobs can entertain certain elements of Luke's sexual abuse and personal history because he never, within the schema of her narrative, enters into or threatens the sacred precincts of manhood. Most of the scholarship on Jacob's narrative focuses, quite appropriately, on the centrality of motherhood and on Jacob's frequent appeals throughout the narrative to the cult of true womanhood. Alongside her claims to femininity and motherhood, though, Jacobs intended her narrative to document the parallel plight of black men, which she understood to complement her model for the black woman as nurturer and sustainer of the race. For example, in a chapter titled, "The Slave Who Dared to Feel Like a Man," she documents at length the parallel struggles of her brother, Benjamin, to sustain an embattled sense of manhood. Luke's story, on the other hand, takes up approximately 2.5 pages of the narrative and focuses on his sexualized treatment, his folk-like ignorance, and his lack of moral perspective. Where Benjamin complements and provides a parallel to his sister's story, Luke represents the extent to which the channel institution can unman an individual in terms of the man-slash-slave dynamic. We might think of Luke, according to Jacob's logic, as the perfect embodiment of the slave. Of all the males, slaves depicted in the narrative, Luke's sexual violation marks him as the most depraved and the most degraded and the most apt object of the male unspeakable. Long before we get to Luke, a poor, ignorant, depraved specimen of manhood, Jacobs drops hints and suggestions that dictate how we are to read and interpret Luke's lack of manhood. The first of these hints comes in chapter 8 of the narrative, titled, What Slaves Are Taught to Think of the North. Jacobs begins by commenting on the deceptive tricks of masters. One master describes to his slaves the horrible and impoverished circumstances of free life. A slaveholder once told me, Jacobs recites, that he had seen a runaway friend of mine in New York, and that she besought him to take her back to her master, for she was literally dying of starvation. That many days she had only one cold potato to eat, and at other times could get nothing at all. According to Jacobs, many of the general mass of slaves believe such lies, which result not only in their physical bondage, but also in the enslavement of their minds and sensibilities. Black men under such circumstances do not understand that freedom could make them useful men. Nor did they understand, according to Jacobs, how freedom could enable them to protect their wives and children. Suddenly, Jacobs argues against the belief that the Negro was innately heathen. She admits that the black man in slavery is a heathen, but blames the state on the absence of proper Christian training, the denial of the paternal role, and the inherently heathen nature of the institution of slavery. Jacobs navigates a fine line between the innately heathen Africa and her New World African-American heathen who is, unlike his ancestors, a victim of circumstances. The slave is heathen, either by ancestry or circumstances, and the man walks free of ideological as well as literal shackles. Heathen black men or slaves, by definition, could not protect their wives and children. They were sneaky, ignorant, and susceptible to the mental suggestions of their masters. Some poor creatures have been so brutalized by the lash, they will sneak out of the way to give their masters free access to their wives and daughters. Do you think this proves the black man to belong to an inferior order of being? Jacobs responds to her own question a couple of lines later. I admit the black man is inferior. In contrast to the inferiority of the slave, Jacobs first chooses for herself a free black man whom she desires to marry. Her master does not allow this union, so she later chooses an erotic relationship with a white man who does not own slaves. Compared with these chivalric models of manhood, Jacobs finds enslaved men an inferior order of beings. Not only can Luke not protect a hypothetical wife or child from abuse, he cannot protect himself from the sexual licentiousness of his master. Luke's unnamed master chains the black man to his bed. Having fallen prey to the vices growing out of the patriarchal institution, Luke's master perpetuates the strangest freaks of despotism. Jacobs leaves it to her reader to imagine the details of these sexual acts, but does make clear in her references to the patriarchal institution and the master's degraded wreck of manhood how thoroughly unmanned is Luke in the process of enslavement. She uses the term patriarchal institution elsewhere in the narrative to refer to masters who sexually violate black women on the plantation. Luke's master treats him like a black woman. Jacobs does not go so far, however, as to label Luke as feminine or womanly. Her politics of black womanhood do not allow for feminine or womanly men. Instead, she references his feminine nature through allusions to the master's sexual dominance and implicit comparisons with other black men who presumably avoid Luke's fate. For example, Jacobs describes Peter, the black man who assists her in her final escape, as a brave, enterprising, noble-hearted man who was a chattel. Technically speaking, Peter is a slave like Luke. However, the author casts Luke as poor, ignorant, and much abused, even after she encounters him following his escape in the north. Within Jacob's paradigm of masculinity, black men fall into one of two categories, man or slave. In the above-mentioned chapter titled The Slave Who Dared to Feel Like a Man, she focuses on the evolution of her brother, Benjamin, from slave to man. The culminating moment of Benjamin's manhood is the prototypical physical battle between slave and master. One day, the master tries to whip Benjamin. He resisted. Master and slave fought, and finally the master was thrown. Benjamin had cause to tremble, for he had thrown to the ground his master, one of the richest men in town. In pursuit of his manhood, Benjamin flees the plantation. His master captures him, he escapes again, and finally he achieves permanent free status in the North. Physical combat, literal escape, and longing for a lost paternal figure typify the journey of the real man that Benjamin represents. Luke, by comparison, does not flee from his abuser, nor does he engage him in a warrior-type physical battle. Instead of depicting Luke as brave, enterprising, and intelligent, Jacobs depicts him as defeated and degraded, a slave who dares not to feel or act as a man. Just because Luke is sexually violated, though, does not mean that he is not brave, enterprising, or intelligent. His escape from slavery indicates, on some level, he maintained a reserve of bravery and enterprise that allowed him to outsmart local paddy rollers and slave catchers. Yet to allow Luke this complexity would necessitate looking more deeply at the erotic tie between master and slave, and on Jacob's part, working from a politics of black womanhood that did not depend upon dichotomies of ennobled man versus emasculated slave. In her presentation of Luke, Jacobs implicitly draws upon plantation codes of black masculine shame and self-blame. According to James Oliver Horton and Lewis Horton, among the slaves, men who refused to submit to the master's authority were accorded respect. Them as won't fight, reported Lewis Clark, is called pokeezy. This unspoken honor code helps explain the sparse historical record regarding male rape. Admission to rape, more than any other act I can think of, would have called into question a black man's honor. Luke's master had greatly diminished physical strength. He had to call in the constable to administer beatings for him. According to the unspoken black male code of honor, Luke represented a least respectable model of black masculinity, if he registered as a man at all. In contrast, black women could undergo rape and still emerge from such circumstances as honorable, contributing members of the race. In the context of racial uplift, both black men and women bartered in black female violation. For black men, it represented the greatest measure of their emasculation, and for black women, such as Jacobs, the reality of rape informed her politics of black womanhood and motherhood. Trudier Harris offers a useful assessment of the gender politics of rape during and following slavery. Her explanation helps us understand why Luke has no gender identity outside of the ambiguous sexuality of the slave. Though rape black women, she contends, were psychologically warped, their sexual violation does not lead to a subtraction from their persons. The implicit reference here is the castrated or emasculated black male. She continues, no matter the father of her children, she still was able to fulfill, in spite of the conditions under which the fulfillment was carried out, her traditional role as woman within the society, that of bearer of children. The black male, on the other hand, could only envision his worth in intangible ways. Harris raises several illuminating and useful points. First, she points to an implicit sexual politics within Black uplift ideology. According to these politics, Black people have historically identified Black women with the womb, with reproduction, while they have identified Black men with the penis or phallic agency. After slavery, lynching and castration came to symbolize Black masculinity and male violation. The raped wife and maternal figure, examples of which proliferate in slave narratives and abolitionist writings, came to signify the defilement of Black womanhood. Luke's sexual violation does not fit neatly into either of these categories. We do not know exactly how his anus and penis were used in the context of sexual abuse. And as far as transcending his sexual violation, his rape does not reap children, the ultimate sign of female accomplishment. The only access to gender and sexuality for Luke and for Black men in general is through the Black woman. If he can have the Black woman, possess her, and protect her, then he is a man. If not, he is devoid of manhood. In Jacob's version of this equation, Black men had neither gender role nor sexual identity outside of their main role of protecting and complementing the Black woman. In this equation, Black male sexual violation is, in and of itself, a zero factor. Black male gender roles mean nothing in relationship to Black or white men. When we speak of the absence of historical examples of male rape, we are implicitly referring to a worldview in which the rape of Black men had no cultural currency, had neither psychic nor political import. And so, in order to tell Luke's story, Jacobs has to work through an alternative constellation of signs and social meanings. Framing Luke as a slave makes this his articulation possible. The slave was already understood in the negative, as the opposite of what the positive and sustaining characteristics of the heroic Black man. Where the heroic Black man stood apart from the relational and affectional ties that endeared and bound Black men to whites, either through escape or frequent acts of resistance, the male slave was erotically available as caretaker, nursemaid, uncle, and domesticated servant. The correlation between Luke and slave status, I am suggesting, should inspire us to look anew at the discursive, implications of the slave within antebellum Black liberationist discourse. Rather than presuming, as we commonly do, that Black people on the whole adopted Victorian attitudes about sexuality, it might be more correct to assume that Black people maintained complicated understandings of the slave's life and being as intrinsically sexualized. Among his numerous meanings, Luke is an indicator of a realm of sexual experience and discourse that 19th century gender and sexual norms only obscure. The Master Epicure. We might recover some of the discursive potential of the slave through a deeper exploration of hunger and consumption on the plantation. The culture of consumption constituted a complicated terrain wherein the slave effected resistance, often occupied a gender and sexual variant status, and constituted self through violent and coercive homoerotic ties to the master. The category of slave in such contexts was essentially fluid and informed by a larger dynamic of plantation incest, relational ties between whites and blacks, and, most importantly, the white person's cultivated hunger for black flesh and soul. Before inserting Luke into the context I am describing, let me first explain the centrality of sex and human consumption within Jacob's narrative. Jacob's depicted scenes of consumption more gruesome than those documented by any of her contemporaries. The only woman to come close to horrors that few wanted to confront was Lydia Maria Child. Child penned the introduction to Jacob's narrative and wrote the widely read An Appeal in Favor of That Class of Americans Called Africans, 1833. An Appeal was a groundbreaking abolitionist tract that documented the horrors of slavery and depicted Africans as having a cultural legacy and an innate moral character. At the age of 31, Child was hailed as the best-known woman writer in America. However, after the publication of An Appeal, most of the Beacon Street homes that had once welcomed its author were henceforth closed to her. The Boston and Athenaeum canceled her membership. Sales for her books declined, and subscriptions to Juvenile Miscellany dropped off so sharply that the magazine ceased publication in 1834. Many had come to know Child as a paragon of female virtue and domestic cultivation. Part of the reason for her ostracization stemmed from her graphic and what some considered licentious and unsexed depictions of slavery. One illustrated page in the text features sketches of more common torture devices, the iron cuffs, iron shackles, thumb screw, and speculum oris, and detailed explanations of how each device functioned. Prefiguring Jacob's depictions of consumption, Child describes a 10-month-old baby boiled alive aboard a slave schooner. In one of the most graphic depictions of plantation violence from the era, Child describes the literal butchering and cooking of a recalcitrant young slave on a Kentucky plantation. Adding insult to the injured, delicate sensibilities of her readers, Child alludes in An Appeal to the fortunes of Bostonians made by the sale of Negro blood, advocates for the legalization of marriage between persons of different colors, and argues against Massachusetts' support of the fugitive slave law. As a result of her own painful social ostracization, and with an eye toward preserving Jacob's female respectability, Child recommended that Jacob compile all of the incidents of flesh consumption and references to human cannibalism in one chapter of the narrative. In the chapter from the slave narrative titled Sketches of Neighboring Slaveholders, Jacobs depicts bodies literally consumed by vermin, literally cooked, or having cooked iron things applied to their flesh. Masters starve their slaves, do not allow them to breastfeed their young, and in other ways introduce bonded persons into the consumptive machinery of slave culture. The idea of slavery itself as a living and consuming thing is difficult to imagine. However, Jacobs brings this reality to life by depicting scenarios of consumption that involve machines, shackles, and mechanical contrivances. As a punishment for trying to escape, one slave was placed between the screws of the cotton gin to stay as long as he had been in the woods. The cotton gin was then screwed down, only allowing him room to turn on his side when he could not lie on his back. The master's placing of the slave literally between the screws of the cotton gin at the point at which the cotton feeds into the machine makes even more graphic the consumptive relationship between chattel person and machine. What follows, while the man is positioned thusly, emphasizes his master's feeding of him to the machinery of slavery. Every morning, a slave was sent with a piece of bread and a bowl of water, which were placed within reach of the poor fellow. 4 days passed, and the slave continued to carry the bread and the water. On the second morning, he found the bread gone, but the water untouched. When he had been in the press 4 days and 5 nights, the slave informed his master that the water had not been used for 4 mornings, and that a horrible stench came from the gin house. The overseer was sent to examine into it. When the press was unscrewed, the dead body was found partially eaten by rats and vermin. Perhaps the rats that devoured his bread had gnawed him before his life was extinct. As I have noted earlier, slaves consistently refer to slavery as a consuming, bloodthirsty institution, and slavers as human butchers and the like. But incidents such as this one applied concrete images and scenario to a reality that we have tended to largely dismiss as metaphoric or a residue of the slave's traumatized imagination. For example, in her slave narrative, The History of Mary Prince, a West Indian slave, Mary Prince makes constant reference to slavery as a process of butchery and to slaves as butchered meat. Describing herself on the auction block, Prince laments, "It was soon surrounded by strange men, who examined and handled me in the same manner that a butcher would a calf or a lamb he was about to purchase." Later in the narrative, she describes her transition from one master to another as going from one butcher to another. While those who study slavery have been willing to acknowledge the authority of slaves to speak on the subject of what slaves feel about the morality of slavery, we have yet to fully grant this acknowledgement to the disturbing reality and moral implications of slave consumption. In addition to the cotton gin punishment, Jacobs records other systemic processes of consumption. On a neighboring plantation, there lived an extremely wealthy man who owned upward of 600 slaves, many of whom he did not know by sight. In response to slaves' frequent stealing and eating of hogs, this master developed a mode of punishment that entailed the culinary preparation of flesh. Of his many styles of punishment, a favorite one was to tie a rope around a man's body and suspend him from the ground. A fire was kindled over him, from which was suspended a piece of fat pork. As this cooked, the scalding drops of fat continually fell on the bare flesh. Typically, in the kitchen of the plantation big house, was a piece of pork fat served as seasoning in, say, a pot of beans or stew. Within a modern-day soul food repertoire, collard greens are still prepared in many kitchens with pork fat or ham hock, a tradition that stems back to slavery. This practice, which makes no sense in our contemporary, largely sedentary and non-agrarian society, was a means by which slaves could avail themselves of desperately needed fat and sustenance that they would need to draw upon during backbreaking field labor. Pork meat was typically associated with starvation and hunger under slavery. Hog stealing reached such proportions that in 1748, Virginia decreed the death penalty for a third offense. Aware of the premium placed on pork meat by the starving slave, this master's punishment was doubly cruel, as it punished the slave first for simply hungering, and second, with the scalding, liquefied flesh that he could otherwise consume as nourishment. Rather than the typical process of fattening up a food source, the inverted man conveys how starvation and hunger induction make the slave ready for consumption. The master demonstrates that the slave is an emotional and physical food source by situating him within an inverted cooking scenario. The master situates the slave below the cooking fire and the scalding grease used to season and temper his flesh. In another less graphic example, Jacob depicts what happens to a man on a plantation caught stealing food. His master chains him to a tree, beats him, and then starves him to the point of visible emaciation. If a slave stole from him, the master, even a pound of meat or peck of corn, if detection followed, he was put in chains and imprisoned, and so kept till his form was attenuated by hunger and suffering. These larger systemic examples of consumption took on more intimate, erotic connotations within the domestic sphere of the plantation, where social death rather than literal death was the preferred outcome. Orlando Patterson's description of the master as human parasite feeding his sense of honor and his sexual appetite through the slave is borne out in the Jacob narrative. Jacobs describes her own master, Dr. Flint, as possessed of a restless, craving, vicious nature. Flint habitually roved about day and night seeking whom to devour. In Jacob's life, Flint's hunger takes on a sexual significance that involves his consistently propositioning her for sex, inviting her to be his concubine, writing notes that spell out explicitly his sexual intentions, and physically abusing her when she does not acquiesce.
Context of white supremacy. That is where we will wrap for this week. We're in chapter 4. We'll pick up there next Friday, same time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Folks have commentary they would like to share on this segment of the reading. Feel free. The number 641-715-3640. And the code is 56494-3#. Press *6 if you would like to participate. I suspect I could be in error. Folks enjoyed the second audio segment a bit more than the first segment, but we shall see. Everyone who has a hand up, line should be open. No commentary from the second audio segment? Maybe everyone was just as disgusted.
No, actually, I did have commentary. I was just trying to find my place. I lost my place in the book. So I guess I'll just start now. I think I just found what I was looking for. Yeah, I do like the second reading better than the first, because he seems not to be making suggestive commentary, I would say, compared to the commentary that was made on Frederick Douglass, on the section on Frederick Douglass. But to get into the text on page 132, he writes, "Rhetorically speaking, without the slave, there could be no liberated black man. They each mutually defined and demarcated the threshold of the other. In terms of consumption, Walker regarded the slave as a natural byproduct of the culture of consumption. Like slabs of meat, slaves are made through acts of butchering and murdering. Their flesh seasoned and tendered through cruel acts of self-consumption. Walker describes how a son might take his mother, who bore him almost to the pains of death, to give birth to him. And by the command of a tyrant, strip her naked as the day she came into the world and apply the cowhide to her. Such initiatory acts make a man into a slave, according to Walker, and render him vulnerable to the consumptive urges of whites, who gorge and satiate themselves upon such twisted acts of violence." So this section is very interesting because it kind of speaks to me to some of the origins of anti-blackness, where you have a black male who's made to strip his own mother and then mercilessly beat her at the command of this white person who owns him and who has been probably sexually and physically abusing and terrorizing both of them. So ultimately, I'm thinking if this happens on a regular basis, eventually his mother might come to despise him as much as the master, because he is now the conduit of her sexual disrespect, as well as the consumption and abuse of her physical person. No different than when you have a black overseer that was propositioned to beat a slave, and if he didn't beat the slave with all the power he could muster, the white overseer would tell him, "If you don't beat her, then I'm going to beat both of you, and I'm going to beat you worse simply because you didn't do what I said." So to me, that kind of facilitates that ability to look at the other black person who's enslaved like you, who is also a victim, as the facilitator of your pain. And it kind of reminds me on a psychological level of some of the stuff I've spoken about in reference to my wife and how she views white people and black people due to her understanding that most of her most painful experiences have come at the hands of some of our own people, black people. So it just kind of made me think of that. Here on the following page, 134,
He writes, Gene Sagan Yellen, the preeminent Jacobs biographer, painstakingly tracks down all manner of minute detail and historical facts from Jacobs' narrative, but leaves untouched the subject of male rape and the broader implications of homoeroticism on the plantation. And for some reason, I thought about this even with the first reading, there seems to be a juxtaposition of male rape and homoeroticism where it's almost like the concept of rape is erotic. And I don't know if that is something that the author is trying to imply, because when you look at homosexuality, it's basically a form of sodomy. And it's sodomy, essentially. And when you're looking at sodomy, it's something that's usually applied in the context of raping someone. So to me, it just seems like the way that homoeroticism and male rape go hand in hand, it's almost like they go hand in hand to the point where they're being juxtaposed against each other, because what would be rape for the black male would be homoeroticism for the white male. But yet he also tries to project, in some cases, the homosexual urges on the victim. So it's just, I find that to be just very interesting. On the following page, he writes, for example, in the chapter entitled The Slave Who Dared to Feel Like a Man, she documents at length the parallel struggles of her brother Benjamin to sustain an embattled sense of manhood. Luke's story, on the other hand, takes up approximately 2.5 pages of the narrative and focuses on his sexualized treatment, his folk-like ignorance, and his lack of moral perspective, where Benjamin compliments and provides a parallel to his sister's story. Luke represents the extent to which the chattel institution can unman an individual. In terms of the man-slave dynamic, we might think of Luke, according to Jacob's logic, as the perfect embodiment of the slave. Of all the male slaves depicted in the narratives, Luke's sexual violation marks him as the most depraved and the most degraded and the most apt object of the male unspeakable. And that, to me, kind of speaks to her, or this section, the understanding of the context in which Luke was being homosexualized. Because he actually did end up running away, which means that there was somewhere in there he was seeking liberation, and that he was forced to deal with the situation that he was given as far as being raped. And I don't know what Mr. Jacobs was thinking, but who's to say that he enjoyed that? You understand what I'm saying? Because later on he ran away from the plantation and freed himself, which indicates that somewhere in there was a burning desire to be free. And I'm pretty sure part of that desire to be free had to do with being free from being raped by another male. I'll stop there and give someone else a chance to speak. Thank you, and I'll meet you later.
Appreciate that. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you have commentary, feel free.
Hello, Matt. Proceed.
Yes, sir.
Greetings. Peace to all of the callers and the hosts. Yes, this interesting portion of the reading, to me, I think it might be evidence that one listens to the cows too often whenever you have a cowbell go off in your head in reading. So, a couple of times. Specifically, I think it was Jacobs who... I don't have the passage in front of me, but she said she got with non-white males and took up relations with a white man. Really interesting how a person who had escaped from slavery, the same behavior sometimes is seen, I've noticed, in non-white people who leave horrific neighborhood conditions, growing up in certain areas and find themselves migrating over to areas where a lot of white people live and having relations with them. I feel that that's a very common pattern in the system of white supremacy, how the confusion and white people who sort of take advantage of that, which is very apt, I believe, in comparison to child molestation. I also thought that the portion that spoke about beating. The beatings, those are much in my mind. I have two young children, and whenever portions of the book talk about beatings, it makes me think of how I was raised a lot of non-white, specifically black children in this part of the world are beat and it's seen as a form of discipline. I mean, I know it's been touched on previously, but it's been ran into my mind, just kind of drilled in about how beating was just such a major part of just the slave's life, specifically holding down someone else. I remember mostly growing up holding down my brother while my mother would beat him. And when I read the passage about holding down his own mother to be beaten by the master, I felt that was telling that we have this lying behavior. And the final point that I thought was kind of marked is this homosexuality and how today there's this modern-day fixation with the butt, the buttocks. And undoubtedly, white society and white supremacists put that out there. That's like this behavior is common to them, and it's more than seen. I mean, because everyone was fair game during that time period, man or woman. The cotton gin scene to me was really telling because it just shows the deaths and also how consumption is just a game. White people are killed and maimed for fun. If it's not an animal, it's a black person. They see it as an animal. And, it's fun for them. So those portions of the reading stuck out to me. I'll take my hand off.
Watch that word fair. Any folks that we have not heard from, second audio segment, do you have commentary?
Yep. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, yes, I found it interesting that in the part of the book where they were talking about, I guess that's Harriet Jacob, depictions of how some slave was treated. Then Charles, they referred to, I believe she's a white woman, and how she was held as the best known woman right in America. And she started to write and reveal some truths, I guess, about the system. And it just shows how when you break a code, how there's consequences to be paid for whites that violate these codes. Then her sales on a book declined, and somebody canceled her membership. So, and some of the things that she revealed were torture devices, iron cuffs, iron shackles, thumb screws, and the specular horse, which is the picture that's on the front of the book. But I'll mute my line. Thanks, girls, for taking the call.
Can I be heard?
You're a little low. If you could speak up, please, Amy.
Sure. Is this any better if I do like this?
Much better.
Okay. I don't, forgive me, I'm driving, so I can't reference the text exactly with page numbers and such. But one of the things that I'm really taking away from the overall text, and I'm sure it'll be solidified towards the end, is the conditioning. He uses the word seasoning, but one of the psychological terms I've been studying is the conditioning process and how you can shape behavior. And although the book isn't emphasizing this as much because the book is not about this, I appreciated the caller before the last caller talking about how she, Ms. Jacobs, said no to a black man's proposal for marriage,
but then entered into a quote-unquote exotic relationship with a white male. And the reason I think that's so interesting, not just because it's, you know, Area 8 and the cowbells and stuff, but that even without mass propaganda, like media and such like we have now, that's still the case, which I would kind of say that the same would be true for, like, okay, for instance, with Tyler Perry, there was a quote on another page where said the grandmotherly role. I can, like, get it later at some other time, but, you know, when you condition behavior, you reward behavior as well. So when people are performing or an organism is performing the way that you want it to, you can reinforce the behavior by rewarding the behavior. And then, you know, studies show that punishment doesn't necessarily stop a behavior. It, like, makes it regress or become, like, hidden, and then it morphs into some other kind of psychological pathology or something that's unhealthy to the individual because they don't want to, you know, express their dislike for something. And when I'm thinking about the homosexualizing of black males, it goes hand in hand with the... Because Frederick Douglass married a white woman, and then Jacobs married a white man. So this isn't a new phenomenon at all. And I've been paying attention to it. I think they are not one and the same, but very, very similar. That, like, that's dissexual or dysfunctional sexual behavior as well. And one other thing that I kind of, this might not, like, mean anything, but to me it meant something that, you know, the whole conversation about the food, I know that's like a motif that's been in the text before, but sometimes I feel like we do ourselves an injustice in thinking that all that we've ever done or that we do, our behaviors, the healthy ones, are something we developed in the system of slavery or in since we've been here. And I don't think that that's true. Like, there are many African foods that incorporate having meat into the vegetable that's cooked, like having turkey neck or whatever with collard greens. And like I said, it's not necessarily related to the homosexualizing of black males, but it's something to point out that, like, our genesis is not here. And even when it comes to food, there are things that we've done, like, that's just a way to get meat and vegetable at the same time. Then the last thing, because I'm almost done, thank goodness, with the blood of Emmett Till. So I've been highlighting in that book as well, the whole consumption of black males, and especially this particular young black male. And the part about the boiling baby, I mean, it's just like the babies and the alligators is one thing. But I never, like, it wouldn't have dawned on me until I heard that. That of boiling an entire black baby on, and however they did it in whatever context. And so in the blood of Emmett Till, there's like this whole long talking about how white people don't do these things to children. Like, these things should not happen to children, but they're always lying. And I think, you know, we've just been so conditioned, our behavior so shaped in such a unhealthy way. Sometimes I'm just like, the book makes me wonder, you know, because it's centuries, like, how, you know, how do we heal from it? And without, like, trying to justify the behavior to say, well, we've been so conditioned, so this is just what we're going to do because we don't know what else to do. So, but with that, thank you.
Any other commentary? Miss anybody? Okay, I'll get in some of my observations, and then we'll see if we have time for other folks. Yeah, I too thought the boiled alive portion was important, and I thought it was significant because I appreciate when people, when they construct a book, and then all of the anecdotes or little stories that are brought in, they all reinforce the main idea or theme that's being presented. And so pulling in this anecdote from another slave memoir where it's, again, the cannibalism is being presented. I thought that was fantastic as well. Let's see. Next up. Really important. We said hundreds of thousands of pages of narratives testimony, recorded speeches, and liberationist tracts written by black men, we have yet to recover overt depictions of male rape or homoeroticism for black women. Such a topic was even more taboo, as it suggested sexual licentiousness and a knowledge of sexual matters that most women disavowed. I think this is really important. I think it's also important, Mr. Fuller's talked about this, we've talked about this on the book publishing end. Racism, white supremacy means that white people decide what books get published, and frequently the editing of the books that are published. I certainly think in 1800s, I could certainly see racists saying, we're not going to publish a book where you talk about one of the joys of slavery is white men raping black males. We're not going to publish a book about that, which is pretty much, I think, the same climate that you have today for the most part. Continuing. Let's see. The portion where she says, this is talking about Harriet Jacobs' memoir, autobiography of all the male slaves depicted in the narrative. Luke's sexual violation marks him as the most depraved, most degraded, and the most apt object of the male unspeakable. Just thought that seemed to give some weight, particularly I think quite a few listeners have said that they think there is something special, something acute about male rape, because that's just that it, everything about that process is a different type of trauma. Rape of anyone, horrible and has traumatic impact, but male rape in particular, people have raised, both male and female listeners have said that they think there's something peculiarly devastating about that. I thought that passage kind of reinforced that at some level. The portion from Jacob's autobiography where she talks, she gives kind of her views on how cowardly black males are who will move out of the way so that white enslavers can rape their black females, their wives or daughters. That is the product of terrorism. You see that even today, where you have black males who cannot, just like Luke, cannot protect themselves from sexual abuse. When I heard that, I thought immediately of Eric Garner or the black male in Paris that they were just writing about, or Abner Louima. When I say Eric Garner, he was choked by the police in New York. But before that, he wrote, documented a report where he said that he had been stopped by enforcement officers, NYPD, and he had been subjected to an anal cavity search in broad daylight, middle of the street. Same thing. So black males today, or back then with Luke, not able to protect themselves, or that's what racism, white supremacy means. When the portion that says Luke's master treats him like a black woman, Jacobs does not go so far, however, as to label Luke as feminine or womanly. Her politics of black womanhood do not allow for feminine or womanly men. I just thought that was interesting, the way it was worded in that way. His white enslaver raping him is treating him like a black woman. And I'm not, that might be accurate. That might be the best way to state it. I just thought that was interesting phrasing. The next portion, for example, Jacobs describes Peter, the black man who assists her in her final escape, as a brave, enterprising, noble-hearted man who was a chattel. Technically speaking, Peter is a slave like Luke. I had Mr. Fuller's voice echoing in my head. What's the difference between a dignified slave and a silly slave? One is dignified, one is silly. I mean, just, you know, yeah, that's nice, you know, that he helped Whoopi, but, you know, you're still on the plantation too. Let's see. I have not read Harriet Jacobs. I was thinking that's one we should read for the book club, but I did not get the part about Luke escaping, where he says Luke is sexually violated, though does not mean that he is not brave, enterprising, or intelligent. His escape from slavery indicates that on some level he maintained a reserve of bravery and enterprise that allowed him to outsmart local paddy rollers and slave catchers. I thought he did not escape, but I guess they're saying, I guess he did escape. I thought he was stuck there, but like I said, I haven't read this, so maybe I just need to go read the book and I'll be clear about all that. Let's see. Moving forward. Yeah, that portion came up again. I think it's stated explicitly where it says, though raped black women, she contends, were psychologically warped, their sexual violation does not lead to a subtraction from their persons. The implicit reference here is the castrated or emasculated black male. She continues, no matter the father of her children, she still was able to fulfill, in spite of the conditions under which the fulfillment was carried out, her traditional role as woman within the society, that of bearer of children. The black male, on the other hand, could only envision his worth in intangible ways. I think that just a more detailed explanation of what the position that some of our listeners have taken. Boiled Alive, we already got one of those depictions. And just the Kentucky aspect, I think we've had enough stories of white people diluting, minimizing slavery when the omissions of all of the things, the rape of males and boiling of children and cannibalism and all of the things that get omitted. Just think, keep that in mind the next time that you hear someone say that, oh, this was a kindly slave master. He wasn't that bad. You know, they gave out extra watermelon on the weekends. Let's see. The passage about the pork I thought was incredible. I appreciated Emmy's commentary as well. But when they describe this punishment of having a black person being hung literally above ground and having pork boiled above them or cooked above them so that the fat is dripping down on the black person, and then contrasting that with seasoning food, seasoning that word again with a piece of fat, like, oh, I just thought that was brilliant comparison. And again, enforcing the main theme of consumption of black people, old black Joe, going back to Dr. Welsing at the beginning. Let's see, anything else I want to make sure I get in before I think I will rest there. That way, folks, if any extra commentary folks need to get in before we conclude, we'll have time to do so. Anything else folks wanted to share before we wrap up?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you so much, Gus. You made some very salient points, as did the other callers. I appreciate each and every one of you, because I always listen back to the reading, usually the day or two afterwards, just to reabsorb it. And you guys have just expanded my consciousness exponentially, and I appreciate it. On page 139, he writes something very powerful, in my opinion. He says, Harris raises several illuminating and useful points. First, she points to an implicit sexual politics run within black uplift ideology. According to these politics, black people have historically identified black women with the womb, with reproduction, while they have identified black men with the penis or phallic agency. After slavery, lynching and castration came to symbolize black masculinity and male violation, the raped wife and maternal figure, examples of which proliferate in slave narratives and abolitionist writings, came to signify the defilement of black womanhood. And what I find most telling about that is when they describe the idea that after slavery, that black masculinity was symbolized by male violation, it just really speaks to me to epigenetics and how if what black masculinity meant was castration and sexual abuse, then ultimately it facilitates the psychology of making more anti-sexual black males or facilitating them being groomed in that direction, even possibly by their mothers or family members in order to facilitate their survival. No different than now you find in Africa elephants being born without tusks due to the excessive poaching. They've been epigenetically changed to no longer grow tusks. And I find that to speak to that epigenetic aspect to the homosexualization of black males. There was a brief section on page 142 towards the bottom where he says, of his many styles of punishment, yeah, this is the one where he speaks about the fat dripping upon him. I found that fascinating as well, because in my ancestry, I have carried black Native American Carib Indian blood in Trinidad. And one thing they used to do to white people, which is where the word barbecue comes from, is they would cook a living white man over an open fire, which is the term they used was barbacoa, which has now become barbecue. And that's the origin of that term, is the Carib word. And I just found that to be fascinating because when the Cavs started doing it, it was in response to what white supremacy was doing to them. And that was their response. So I found that to be a very powerful part of the text. And excuse me, lastly, on the following page, he writes, rather than the typical process of fattening up a food source, the inverted man conveys how starvation and hunger induction makes the slave ready for consumption. The master demonstrates that the slave is an emotional and physical food source by situating him within an inverted cooking scenario. The master situates the slave below the cooking fire and the scalding grease used to season and temper his flesh. In another less graphic example, Jacobs depicts what happens to a man on a plantation caught stealing food. His master chains him to a tree, beats him, and then starves him to the point of visible emaciation. If a slave stole from him, the master, even a pound of meat or a peck of corn, if detection followed, he was put in chains and imprisoned and so kept until his form was attenuated by hunger and suffering. And what I find is that the white person is, in that instance, is doing a form of voyeuristic consumption. So he's eating the slave in the form of the slave's body eating itself from being physically starved. And it's actually showing up in the form of him becoming emaciated, but that's really the master's doing. So the master is actually the one consuming him by forcing him to consume himself. And that is just the most twisted, psychologically debased thing that I've ever seen. And it's just further reinforces that we have to really do something about white people. Thank you. And I'll meet my line.
Hear, hear. The problem is white people. Anything else folks wanted to get in before we conclude? Are folks satisfied?
Can I be heard just before we end really quick?
Yes, ma'am.
After listening to some of the things that you said, and I heard it back, because I have felt that there's been something peculiar or different or special or unique. But one of the things that I'm going to consider in the rest of the reading of the text and then make my final conclusions when we conclude is there really a difference between male and female rape and male rape? Like, is there really a difference? Or is the difference that we've been so conditioned to assume that rape between a male and a female is just not as bad? But, I mean, I'm female, and if it's a, you know, I'm not a man or I'm not a male, so, you know, I know there's a lot that comes with that, but I'm saying, is there really a difference? Or is we've been so conditioned to think that there's a difference and one is worse than the other? They're both heinous violations. Because I've held that opinion myself, so I'll just put that out there. Maybe other people will consider, and when we, you know, conclude, we'll see, you know, what the consensus is. And then I'm glad that you said there was the quote that I can't read back because I'm driving, but about the black female still being able to fulfill her function. I don't know that that means that we as black females, like, still felt, I understand what the author is saying, but I'm not so sure that I agree. And I just have to put that on the books. It's something I'm going to consider. I'm up in the air about that because that's just biological, like sperm, egg, baby, 9 months later, boom. Also, that's something that, like, she kind of had to do because that was mandated of her by the system. So I don't know, like, that's, like, there's a whole element to that. Just because I give birth doesn't mean that I still feel like a woman. I'm just female, like, and I'm producing more slaves for white people. So I could be incorrect. I will remember that I said this, and in my final conclusions, like, really see how I feel about that. But it seems I'm not so sure. It's like we're accepting something that really is unacceptable at the moment. So I hope other people will consider, because I really do, I'm interested to know what other people say. So thanks.
Grant. We will wrap there for the day and pick up. We'll be next week picking up in Chapter 4, same time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We'll be here tomorrow. Compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, 6 p.m. Pacific. Looking forward, reviewing what's taken place over the last 7 days. If anybody has seen Get Out, not that I encourage going to the movies, feel free to give us the rundown on what you saw. If you go see it, not an endorsement. I just suspect that we do have some listeners who might be going to the movies this weekend. With that, Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. I hope it has been a constructive investment of your Friday evening. I will state again, this whole weekend, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. I'd have seen no evidence that being under the influence of tobacco, alcohol, cannabis, any other toxins that whites come up with, I've seen no evidence that consuming those substances will help us neutralize Darren Wilson, Daniel Holtzclaw, any other race soldiers, badge or no. I think Dr. Welsing, she would want our brain computers operating at maximum efficiency under or us being sober. That's what I think she would encourage. Started off the broadcast this evening with the words of Dr. Welsing. Invoke her name again. Thanks for tuning in. If you have questions, problems, can't find something in the archives, drop us an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. Guest suggestions as well, untiljustice@gmail.com. Thank you kindly for tuning in. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.